Good Thursday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad you joined us today, coming to you once again from beautiful Farmville, Virginia, site of the 2016 vice presidential debate and a mixed martial arts event. That part hasn't been formally announced. I'm discussing at the rate we're going. It'll be added sometime this summer. Coming up on the program, Chip Eberhardt of Top Shot Academy, talking about the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day in Springfield, Illinois yesterday. John Daniel Davidson of the Federalist, why the activists left can't help its intolerance. Mayor Rick Austin of Demarest, Georgia, where the city has just approved city employees who are concealed carry holders being able to carry while they are at work. Citizens of Demarest, Georgia, can also carry in these city buildings. And so the mayor thought, well, if the citizens can, why can't the employees? We'll chat with Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart News in Hour 3. Rick Unger of Steel and Unger on Sirius XM POTUS about the campaigns hitting the Empire State. As a matter of fact, we'll start there with our friend Jim Garrity from National Review. Jim, how you doing, sir?
Cam, how are you today?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. And, I do want to talk about New York, but I guess we should talk a little bit about Wisconsin first here. Were you surprised by any of the by the results on Tuesday on either the Republican or Democratic side?
Yeah, we'll get to Sanders in a second, but I would say the margin on the Republican side surprised me. I had kind of guessed, you know, most of the polling, other than one big outlier, had Cruz ahead in the high single digits, and he ended up winning by about 15 points. Now, people had noted that Wisconsin kind of stands out because in most of Republican Party discussions of the last year, year and a half, you have the conversation, oh, the angry grassroots and the out-of-touch establishment. And despite the fact that Scott Walker did not have a enormously successful effort to run for president this last cycle. In fact, he was the first guy to depart the race. He's been a pretty darn good governor in the eyes of a lot of Wisconsin Republicans. So this goes to grassroots activists and as well as the folks who are work in politics professionally. There isn't that big divide, that big gap of understanding or gap of attitude. And you saw, you know, radio interviews like Charlie Sykes and the folks who are kind of the leaders of that grassroots community, think they've been doing a pretty good job. They feel like Walker and his administration, the lawmakers in the state capitol, generally listen to them. So when Trump arrives and his whole attitude is this, we're going to throw the bums out of Washington and nobody ever listens to us and we're the silent majority, it kind of fell on deaf ears. It didn't really resonate as much as it did in other states. And Scott Walker endorsed Ted Cruz, did so with great enthusiasm. And, you know, a couple of folks might have thought that, okay, it's kind of the upper Midwest. This might be John Kasich territory. John Kasich underperformed his polls by a pretty considerable margin. So the question is, was this Kasich supporters voting strategically and saying, look, well, you know, I like Kasich best, but it's really important that Trump not win, so I'm going to vote for Cruz? Or is something happening where John Kasich is just not as likable as he'd like to be? He'd hoped to be in a state like this. And maybe, Kasich did not win in Michigan. Some people attributed that to lingering distrust of an Ohio State Buckeye. Kasich was quick to emphasize that, you know, 364 days out of the year, he loves the state of Michigan.
Uh-huh.
Until they have the big game. But for whatever reason, you know, Kasich is not necessarily lighting it up in every single Midwestern state. So, you know, a bit of a reset for this. Now, the next state that votes is New York, and Donald Trump is expected to do very well there. And I don't see any reason in any of the polling so far to doubt that he will win, and he will win big in New York. So, and on the Democratic side, you know, Cam, do you remember, wasn't this supposed to be, around Super Tuesday, this race was over for the Democrats, and Hillary had won, and Bernie Sanders had one or two good contests, and we were all supposed to forget about this, right?
Yeah, that's how it was supposed to turn out. But, you know, interestingly enough, while the media has been fascinated with covering every asset and even inventing some asset, aspects of the Republican race to cover, Jim, there has been this streak by Bernie Sanders. What is it, 7 of the last 8 races?
Yeah.
He has won?
Yeah, 6 straight, 7 of the last 8, and he's expected to win in Wyoming on Saturday. So you look at that. If there was this memo saying, hey, this race is over, time to unite behind Hillary, which is allegedly what President Barack Obama was telling high-level Democratic donors around mid-March, they either didn't get that memo or they said, heck with you.
Well,
no.
Look, maybe the high-level donors did get the memo, but maybe the non-high-level donors didn't. You know, it strikes me that you look at Wisconsin's exit polls. Hillary Clinton lost those under the age of 50 handily, Jim. And the younger you get, the more skewed it was. I think among 18 to 24-year-old, Sanders won 80%, maybe more than 80% of the vote. So, I think what you're seeing here and what the media loves to talk about and what we on the right are kind of obsessed about as well is, you know, you're seeing this fracture and the split between the quote-unquote establishment forces and the insurgent forces, or what used to be the grassroots, maybe, you know, inside, outside the Beltway parts of the movement. It's not just happening on the right. It's happening on the left as well. And you've got a lot of people who, frankly, I don't know how they arrive at this conclusion, but they're very disappointed in the Obama administration, not for the same reason that you might be or that I might be, but because the president didn't go far enough, right? He's not a true believer, and Hillary Clinton's more of the same. She's a Wall Street sellout. She's, you know, she's more interested in herself than she is, you know, real progress. Bernie Sanders is the more authentic candidate, and this is a year in which apparently authenticity and outsider status means a great deal to a large portion of the electorate. I think that's coming into play a lot. And so I think President Obama can talk to the party bosses. He can talk to the superdelegates. There's a story out right now over at Hot Air. I think Al Pundit's talking about this, Wall Street Journal, on how the superdelegates are not shifting despite the surge for Bernie Sanders among the Democratic voters. And I think because of the superdelegate status on the Democrat side, I think actually, you know, when it comes to the convention, if this streak for Sanders doesn't necessarily continue, because I don't know if he's going to win New York, but if there's a healthy number of delegates and a healthy number of voters who support Bernie Sanders, who view Hillary Clinton as a fatally flawed candidate, and this comes down to superdelegates, Jim, this could be a very ugly and disastrous convention for both parties this year.
Yeah. There's a kind of fascinating contrast when you look at how the two primaries have been covered.
Mm-hmm.
I would contend a lot of this stems from the fact that most members in the media, including what Mark Helper used to use the term, the gang of 500, meaning that there were the 500 most influential writers, TV anchors, producers, columnists, those folks all pretty much based in Washington, who have the single biggest say in what the media coverage of politics is going to be on any given day. And I think at one point he jokingly alluded, but it indicates kind of this metaphor, that of the gang of 500, 3 were Republicans. that most members of this group are either Democrats, or they are either, if they aren't registered Democrats, then they are
only
in once in a million years would they vote for a John Huntsman type. They really are pretty darn left of center. But the interesting thing is that they are they're not in the same line as your average, you know, Bernie Sanders. They're not in touch with, say, Black Lives Matter. They're not necessarily in touch with Code Pink. Maybe if they've ever encountered Everytown USA, Cam, it's been a fundraiser, right? They don't march with those people.
Brady campaign gala, like,
exactly.
is
high level events, but not necessarily, you know. Planned Parenthood, NARAL, all that kind of crowd. But otherwise, you know, they're not grassroots there. And so they look at Hillary Clinton and they say, oh, it's perfect. What a perfectly sensible, great selection. And they can, you know, talk themselves into enjoying this and appreciating this. And what's more, they look at the Republican primary this year. And earlier this year I described it as the Hindenburg crashing into the Titanic. No doubt. This is an ugly, messy, passionate, furious fight between different groups of Republicans. Some folks from outside the Republican Party coming in, brought in by enthusiasm of Donald Trump. Folks who are, you know, kind of more philosophical conservatives, and some who basically are kind of see themselves more utilitarian. You know, we had 17 candidates in this, and then they all beat the heck out of each other. Indisputably, this is worthy of coverage. And the Gang of 500, you know, your Democratic or leaning members of the media love covering this. Mm-hmm. Because, one, it's a whole bunch of Republicans yelling at each other, right? And it's fun, and they're insulting each other. They're talking about their manhoods. You know, and it's kind of like watching, oh, my God, look at this freak show. Look at this. You know, who in a million years would ever want to be associated with this circus, these freaks, this, you know, bar scene from Star Wars, you know. But when you see the Bernie versus Hillary Clinton, you know, it's like watching a family fight. Oh, God, why can't those Democrats get along? He really shouldn't say that about Hillary.
What was the tweet last night? Some guy was like, Bernie, you take that back, saying Hillary's not qualified to be president. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, some egg on Twitter. It was
Ron Fournier, I want to say, something like.
It was a Ron Fournier type.
Something like, when you're calling Hillary unqualified, it's time to end your campaign, Bernie. You know?
It was right.
Just like, that's out of line. You take it. And one, notice how they, you know, they rushed to Hillary's defense. And look, here's the thing. Based on pure, what it was.
This, by the way, is after Hillary Clinton accused Bernie Sanders of siding with gun manufacturers over the families of murdered children.
Yeah, I mean, like,
and you didn't see, I didn't see any tweets of, hey, Hillary, why don't you, you know, tone it down a little bit?
Yeah, and look, when, you know, when he called her unqualified, he did it over, you know, the oil and gas donations, which, mm-hmm. you know, all right, fine, whatever. And there was something else where it was like, you know, you and I, we've had Bernie Sanders' ear cam, like that would ever happen. We could have said, hey, Hillary, you're not qualified because you can get indicted any minute now. Strikes us as a pretty good line. Or, hey, Hillary, you're not qualified because you sacrificed national security because you didn't want to change phones, you know. There were other directions he could have gone on with that. But he did that after she had attacked him, and, you know. And so you look at this fight, and on the, you know, when Democrats fight, the media rushes to pour water onto the fire, right? Put that out. Oh, everybody calm down. No. But when Republicans fight, they pour gasoline onto it. And, you know, what do you think of Donald Trump's comments? Do you agree? Do you disagree? Do you denounce him? You know, and that double standard is there. But as much as the media, like, what are the kind of, I'm trying to think of some sort of slogan kind of to describe this phenomenon, Cam. Basically, it's like reality always wins. No matter how much you deny reality at some mm-hmm. point there, as much as the media might want to say, oh, okay, the party is unifying around Hillary, if the party isn't unifying around Hillary, you're going to get election results where it's very clear the party is not unifying around Hillary. And now all of a sudden everybody's got to drastically change the conventional wisdom, and we will see how things shake out. But, you know, the irony is that, you know, Sanders is on this very steady pace. He's going to get 40-some percent of the vote. He's going to get 40-some percent of the non-of the mundane delegates, is that what we call them?
The little people, I believe, is the official title. You've got the superdelegates,
and
you've got the proletariat. They're not the advance guard of the revolution.
You want to call them. Whatever, you know, the delegates that are not super, he's going to get a really big chunk of them. You know, not a majority, but a really big minority. And this is the sort of thing where traditionally in a campaign like this, you'd either, you know, that would either get you the running mate position, and I don't think I see any Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders unity ticket coming in the future. You get a pretty key, you know, cabinet post, or you get a big speech at the convention. Now, the party recognizes, okay, you speak for a good chunk of the party. We will award you with this. We will give you the spotlight. We will acknowledge your significance to the party as a whole. But you got to, you know, fall in line for our nominee. And Bernie Sanders just does not seem like the kind of guy who's going to do that. But I guess that's, you know, that's why they play the game, so to speak.
Yeah. Do you think there'll be a move, by the way, of the Democratic National Convention to rename superdelegates because it is, in fact, a microaggression against the regular delegates to not be super?
I was going to say, it's as I'm going through this, it's really hard to not come up with a name that isn't kind of condescending to the regular delegates. You know, regular delegates, mundane delegates. Was it Muggles in Harry Potter if you didn't have magical abilities?
It was. Yes.
The Muggle delegates, you know.
Those are the Muggles, right. And then you've got the wizards. And they'll be...
In Robert Byrd's case, literally.
Talking with Jim Garrity. Oh, yeah. That's all right. Talking again with Jim Garrity from National Review about some of the issues of the day. So moving on from Wisconsin. And I one other note, actually, before we move on from Wisconsin. So, you know, it was interesting. I looked at the breakdown of the state. I think it was the Journal Sentinel had the maps. Over on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders basically won every part of the state except for Milwaukee, right? And Cruz did well. You know, you talk about talk radio and Charlie Sykes and the Wisconsin radio guys. Cruz did well in those urban and suburban areas. Rural Wisconsin, where maybe they're not getting somebody like Charlie Sykes on the radio, Trump actually won a lot of those counties. And so it's an interesting split. I don't know, you know, if this translates in any way, shape, or form to the demographics of New York, where, you know, again, you've got a huge population center in New York City, and then you've got upstate New York, which is very, very different culturally and politically. The voters in that part of the state are very different. So as you look ahead to New York, Jim, I mean, do you see what do you see on the horizon for the Republican and the Democratic campaigns?
Your assessment is correct. I think for what it's worth, not that, you know, Manhattan and New York City has a ton of Republican voters, but to the extent they do, I would figure they would be fairly pro-Trump. This is obviously where Trump lives, where he's kind of been, you know, even before he was this national icon, he's always been this huge, larger-than-life figure in New York media. I'm sure people remember the New York tabloids having fun with his messy divorce and things like that, but you look at the media figures who are based out of New York, who are conservative talkers, the Sean Hannitys of the world, the Bill O'Reillys, the gang on the Five, or most of the gang on the Five, other than Dana Perino and Greg Gutfeld, the ladies on Outnumbered at Fox News, they're all pretty pro Donald Trump. In some cases, you know, maybe bending over backwards in a rather clear sense. So I actually think that to the extent that the Republican votes, and then you start looking at, you know, let's say Staten Island, the Long Island crowd, where Trump had a rally there the other night, I actually think, you know, Trump will clean up in this area. So whatever, you know, it's not to say that Trump has a weakness in urban areas. He's actually done pretty well in urban areas, including in you know, when he won the Florida primary and a couple other places. I do kind of think it is interesting, though, that besides his strength in the city, his message on, you know, we're gonna change the trade deals and we're gonna bring back jobs and we're gonna stop the illegal immigrants from taking our jobs. Look, Western New York and upstate New York has had some brutal years. You know, you look at we don't buy Polaroids from Kodak anymore. It's kind of a, you know, there's a lot of an old industrial base there that is still waiting for that comeback, and you know, Cuomo has announced certain tax breaks and things like that, but this is an area where, you know, if you say, hey, you've been ignored and you've been left behind by this economy, that is a message that you would think is going to resonate. So, you know, as much as you can consider this an argument against interest, or you could say I'm trying to, you know, set unrealistic expectations for Donald Trump, I figure he's going to win by about a bazillion votes. No, I expect he's going to do very, very well in the New York primary. And if he doesn't, it would be a real warning sign to him. But I think probably he will do, you know, pretty darn well in New York and New Jersey and kind of the entire, you know, every area covered by the New York media. I think he just kind of has this built-in advantage through both persona and just ubiquitous presence in those markets going back decades.
All right. Does Bernie stand a chance in New York?
No, but here, even in these states, like, notice there hasn't been a lot of states where Bernie Sanders gets blown out, right? So, you know, on a good state, he's going to win, you know, 55%. And on a bad day, he's going to win, like, 40, 45%, you know? So in a two-person race, he's going to get anybody who's not thrilled by the thought of this. Now, he, you know, also worth noting, for what it's worth, that Bernie Sanders, you know, grew up in New York City. He can point back to some roots. You can definitely still hear it in his accent. I think Hillary Clinton was, you know, has every reason. So if Hillary Clinton somehow loses the New York state primary, then all of a sudden I think they hit the panic button over at the Democratic Party. I think that'd be a giant glaring sign. And look, you know, sometimes these wins have this tendency to momentum begets momentum. And I kind of feel like, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, I have a piece over on National Review Online right now pointing that Hillary Clinton is looking really good in the head-to-head matchups with Donald Trump. In fact, she's got a double-digit lead, and it seems to be getting a little bit bigger each time the pollsters go back to this. But if you look at her favorable-unfavorable rating, it's about the same. It has not improved. And if you look at it, whether she's honest and trustworthy, that's actually getting worse. So when Hillary looks better against Trump, that's entirely reflective of him. It's not about whether she's become more likable, more trustworthy, more trusted, more inspiring or anything like that. The American people, by and large, aren't really all that big fans of Hillary Clinton. They just dislike Trump more. And I kind of, at some point, I wonder if Sanders starts making that argument that Hillary is a great pick if the Republicans nominate the guy who, according to current polling, would be the most unpopular nominee of any major party nominee going back 30, 40 years. Or, you know, but if they don't, if Cruz ends up pulling this out, or there's a, you know, convention fight and you end up with somebody new or Rubio or Kasich or something, all of a sudden Hillary Clinton still looks quite weak. And so as much as it's been a really lousy year for Republicans, they can pull it together if they can, you know, come out of Cleveland unified. But, hey, what are the odds of that, right, Kim?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We had Congressman Mike Kelly from Pennsylvania on the program yesterday. He had a piece in USA Today this week talking about the need to think hashtag never Hillary and to, you know, keep in mind he's urging that unification somehow, some way, against all odds. Maybe that should be the theme song, Jim, of the Republican National Convention. Take a look at me now, against all odds. I don't know if Phil, I almost said Phil Squire, but Phil Collins would approve the release of that song. But it does appear to be a somewhat daunting task right now. But I'm an eternal optimist. I am.
Yeah, there was a
it's hard
point
sometimes,
that,
but I am.
Yeah, my colleague Jonah Goldberg said yesterday, which is true, is that you go into a big fight like that with the attitude of my guy must win. And then you have the first ballot vote, then you have a second ballot vote, then you have a third. But, you know, eventually it goes on, and all of a sudden it goes from my guy must win to my guy must win something. My guy must get something. You know, or more importantly, my guy must not lose everything. And it turns into this this attitude of, okay, we must get out of here in Cleveland at some point. We must have a nominee who we, you know, think has a decent shot in November. And those competing interests begin to kind of nag at people. So, look, at this point, it's still anybody's guess how these things shake out. Look, for everybody who kind of got tired of the first three states picking the nominee, all of a sudden it's, you know, we're casting meaningful votes well into April and all the way to June 7th probably.
You know, and in that sense, I think we'll continue to see this you know, genuine excitement, even beyond just the regular candidate. I mean, for the first time, Jim, and who knows, I mean, really, how long has it been since a California Republican primary meant something?
Mm.
You know, what does that do for the voter excitement in other parts of the state? I know, you know, does it give you a little bit of an advance in ramping up that that turnout model in November?
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind that when you talk about a primary electorate, you know, 2012, it was in the neighborhood of like 20 million votes. And then you look at the Republican primary, and then you look at the 2012 total vote, and it was close to like 120 million people. So you're dealing with two different universes. Having said that, if you have a nice list of supporters and potential volunteers and door knockers and you know, get out the vote folks, if all those people are on your list in, you know, because you had a really tough, hard-fought primary, well, you can turn around and reuse them in November. You know where those people are. They haven't moved. They haven't changed their numbers. So it can be helpful. I mean, everyone, you know, there are a lot of people who asked whether the 2008 primary between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama was going to hurt the Democrats, and history demonstrated, no, it really didn't. They managed to mobilize a huge amount of voters, and, you know, parties can unite after tough primaries. But, you know, experience has just taught me never to be – I admire your sunny optimism, Cam, and I expect it will not turn out that way.
Jim Garrity from National Review, our pessimistic friend here on NRA News, Cam and Company.
Listen, happy Thursday, everybody.
Happy Thursday, Jim. All right, well, listen, we will. I'll see you next week, actually. I will be up
looking
there.
Looking forward to that, Cam.
And looking forward to seeing you as well. In the meantime, stay cheery, buddy.
Always, Cam. All right, take care.
We'll talk to you soon. Jim Garrity joins us from National Review here on NRA News, Cam and Company. When we come back after a quick timeout, we're going to talk a little bit more about the election. Hillary Clinton, you know, has been hitting Bernie Sanders hard I guess that's an accurate term for it, on guns. This is one of the areas in which she feels like she can try to draw some daylight between her and Bernie Sanders and run to the left while Bernie Sanders is attacking her for her ties to Wall Street. She's going to say that he's soft on gun control. This got to the point yesterday where Hillary Clinton again accused Bernie Sanders of siding with gun manufacturers over the families of children who were murdered in Newtown, Connecticut. This is the headline from the Washington Post. And again, I think this describes the tone and tenor of the media covering the Democratic campaigns very, very well. Clinton attacks Sanders on guns, but the truth is complicated. The truth is complicated. This is Paul Waldman. Third paragraph in. In this case, Clinton seems to be attacking Sanders unfairly. There's no seems about it. Not only is Hillary Clinton attacking Bernie Sanders unfairly, which, you know, by the way, Candace attacking Candace unfairly, not exactly breaking news in politics, but she is completely misrepresenting what the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act is, what it does and does not do, as well as advancing this legal theory. And as an attorney, I'd love to hear her talk more about this legal theory that would hold the manufacturers of legal products responsible for the criminal misuse of those products. Because, again, you couldn't have a carve-out just for industries that you don't like the firearms industry. You're going to be talking about every industry out there. It's interesting. They were talking about this in The View. We're going to share this clip later on in the show, but even the hosts of The View instinctively understand this is going to be really, really hard to justify holding manufacturers accountable for the actions of criminals. In fact, one of the women on The View even brought up this is like suing the car manufacturer for somebody driving drunk and hurting somebody else. Again, most people understand the legal problem with this theory. I think probably even Hillary Clinton understands the problem with this legal theory, but it doesn't matter to Hillary Clinton. What matters to Hillary Clinton, again, is making false promises, again, quite frankly, about what she would do and what the effects of her actions would have on public safety in this country. The NRA sent out a tweet earlier today with a story. Her own superdelegate, Peter Shumlin, who's the governor of Vermont, is pushing back against something else that Hillary Clinton has said, again, going after Bernie Sanders. We'll talk about that in a second. But they use the hashtag liar, liar, pantsuit on fire, which I have to say I like. And unfortunately, we are seeing more lies from the Clinton campaign. We're going to talk about the truth of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. We're going to talk about the truth of guns from Vermont flooding into New York State, responsible for New York's violent crime rate. We're going to talk about all that after a quick timeout. So stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up next.
Speaking with Eric Lipp with the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program. Tell us about the new website for kids that you guys have going on.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a brand new interactive website just for kids now. It goes along with our materials, our written materials that we've always had in the past. But if you go to eddieeagle.com, real simple, can't get any easier. You go to eddieeagle.com. You can obviously watch our video. There's some storybooks that kids can go along with. There's coloring pages. There's a sing-along, and a bunch of other good stuff. And we're going to keep growing that section. And it's just for kids. It works on iPads, your phone, everything that kids are on these days. And it's a great, great resource for parents.
So we have the Eddie Eagle. There's a component for the adults and people interested in programming. This is specifically for kids.
Correct. Yeah, we have eddieeagle.nra.org for parents. It's the same website we've always had. It has stuff for parents. You can download information on the program. You can download instructor information if you actually want more materials to actually teach to your kids. But we've just created the new site is eddieeagle.com. It's just for kids. It's formatted all for kids. Like I said, it works great on iPads. It's a real hit. We did a lot of Great American Outdoor Show with it, and it's got just a ton of interactive stuff for just kids.
Beautiful. It's always good to see Eddie keeping up with the times, Eric. And tell folks who don't know, what is the Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program?
The Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program is a very simple, easy program. It's all centered for children pre-K through fourth grade, that if they ever come across a firearm, they need to stop, don't touch, run away, tell a grown-up. Everything's centered simply about safety. We're not here out to push the NRA or be a political program. We're just strictly a safety program, and we've been around for quite a while. We're actually about to reach our 29 millionth child.
29 million kids. How can folks get more information about this?
They can obviously just go to the website, eddieeagle.com.
Eric Lipp, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Not a problem. Thanks for having us.
I emigrated from Venezuela, one of the most dangerous countries in the world today. A few years ago, the government came for our guns. We were told we would be safer without them. Of course, the politicians, the rich and famous, their bodyguards and criminals, they still have their guns. Everyone else lives in fear. Mothers and fathers are powerless to defend their families. But the drug cartels and gangs, the colectivos, still have all the guns they want, and 90% of murders are never solved. The biggest mistake Venezuelans made was believing that this could never happen. Today, they would do anything for the Second Amendment freedom that we enjoy as Americans. Never, ever take it for granted. I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I am freedom's safest place.
I grew up on the south side of Chicago. You know it as one of the most dangerous cities in America. I know it as something less than America, a place where the law doesn't matter. It's illegal for criminal gang members, drug dealers, and felons to even touch a gun. Chicago's politicians could clean the streets tomorrow just by enforcing that federal law. But they would rather attack the gun rights of good people than crack down on the violent criminals who terrorize them. So law-abiding Southsiders put their kids to bed to the sound of gunfire, with no hope but to pray it doesn't come closer. Chicago's injustice is America's problem. Either we fight this cancer of corruption, or we pray it doesn't come closer. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler Chip Eberhardt. Those of you tuning in online just saw Chip in the Freedom Safest Place spot. He was speaking at the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day rally in Springfield yesterday. He's going to join us on the program in just a few minutes. Before we took a break, we were talking about Hillary Clinton going after Bernie Sanders, really going after the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. She's trying to draw some daylight between her and Bernie Sanders, thinks that this is one place where she could do so. She said in an interview published today, quote, that he would place gun manufacturers' rights and immunity from liability against the parents of the children killed at Sandy Hook is just unimaginable to me. And again, I didn't see any tweets from concerned Democrats saying, Hillary, maybe you should just, you know, tone it down a little bit. Bernie got that last night. At the Washington Post, and yes, at the Washington Post, Paul Waldman says, well, it seems pretty clear what side of that argument you'd want to be on, right? But in this case, Clinton seems to be attacking Sanders unfairly. He then quotes a portion of an interview that Sanders did with the New York Daily News, again, a very anti-gun publication. And the New York Daily News says there's a case currently waiting to be ruled on in Connecticut. The victims of the Sandy Hook massacre are looking to have the right to sue for damages from the manufacturers of the weapons. Do you think that that is something that should be expanded? And Sanders said, do I think that the victims of a crime with a gun should be able to sue the manufacturer? Is that your question? The New York Daily News said, correct. Sanders said, no, I don't.
Daily News. Let me ask you. I know we're short on time. Two quick questions. Your website talks about, and he says, no, let me just, I'm sorry. In the same sense that if you're a gun dealer and you sell me a gun and I go out and I kill him, gestures to someone in the room, do I think that the gun dealer should be sued for selling me a legal product that he misused? He shakes his head, no. But I do believe that gun manufacturers and gun dealers should be able to be sued when they should know that guns are going into the hands of wrong people. So if someone walks in and says, I'd like 10,000 rounds of ammunition, you know, well, you might be suspicious about that. So I think there are grounds for those suits, but not if you sell me a legal product. Waldman at the Washington Post says Sanders is making an important distinction, which is that manufacturers and sellers should be liable for certain kinds of behaviors that create the conditions for gun violence to occur, but not for the simple fact of making and selling guns that are eventually used to kill people. Waldman says that may have provided the opening for Clinton to attack him, but the truth is that their policy positions at this point aren't really that different. Waldman goes on to say that the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, quote, does leave a little bit of room for lawsuits. Now, he says, but you essentially have to prove that the seller or manufacturer that you're suing should absolutely have known that the gun in question was going to be used in a crime, which is a very high bar to cross. He says the Sandy Hook lawsuit rests on the theory that one of the guns Adam Lanza used to kill all those children, an AR-15, has no legitimate civilian use, and therefore when the company sold it to civilians, including Lanza's mother, they were knowingly providing the tool of mass murder and nothing else. Their argument is that that this is not a firearm that has any legitimate or lawful purpose, which, by the way, is an argument that is at odds with that Fourth Circuit decision a couple of months ago. Granted, Connecticut's not in the Fourth Circuit. But their argument is that this gun, which is commonly owned by millions of Americans for lawful purposes like competitive shooting, hunting, self-defense, is in fact a battlefield weapon of war that should not be available to civilians, even though it is. Waldman says in the Washington Post, that argument seems like a long shot, to put it mildly, which is another way of saying he doesn't think that the argument is really going to hold up in court. But he says if it succeeds and is widely accepted by other courts, it would indeed have the effect of making manufacture of that type of rifle impossible, essentially banning quote-unquote assault weapons without actually banning quote-unquote assault weapons. Waldman says it's perfectly fine for Sanders not to have been familiar with the details of this lawsuit. It hadn't gotten all that much attention. I don't think that he was any more or less familiar with it than the interviewer from the New York Daily News, quite frankly. Waldman says, given that Sanders' first impulse when asked a question about this issue is to say that he doesn't want to see manufacturers and sellers driven out of business, it seems that Sanders is uncomfortable with the idea of doing through the courts what can't be done through legislation. That's a question, Waldman says, that both he and Clinton should have to address specifically. A legal strategy targeted gun manufacturers could succeed where legislative strategies have failed. And Waldman says such a strategy would be much easier if the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act were repealed, but it would be an entirely different way of going about restraining gun violence. Now, what's fascinating here is that I don't know anything about Paul Waldman, but he doesn't talk about the fact that this has been done before. This legal strategy has been used before. Why do you think we have the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act in the first place? Because going back to the last time that Hillary Clinton not running for president, but back in the 1990s when her husband was in the White House and she was the first lady, this was part of the anti-gun strategy. To sue manufacturers out of business, to try to sue gun stores out of business. You had cities filing these lawsuits. You had anti-gun attorneys that were working pro bono. And the idea wasn't that, look, they wanted that big win, right? They wanted that sort of tobacco-style win. But even if they didn't get that, and it wasn't likely that they were going to get it because their legal cases were weak, they could drag these cases out so long that they could, in essence, affect a death by a thousand cuts to the industry. And just throw as many lawsuits out there as possible, keep them dragging on as long as possible, keep the legal fees going and getting them racked up as high as possible. And then, you know, if the lawsuit gets thrown out right before it goes to a trial or if it it doesn't proceed any further. Man, well, you know, at least we've still cost them X number of dollars in legal fees. So by 2005, by the time the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act actually gets approved by Congress, you already have dozens of states around the country that had enacted similar legislation because this was a problem. And it wasn't reducing violent crime. It wasn't, again, it wasn't aimed at the perpetrators of violent crime. It was an attempt to go after firearm manufacturers, not violent criminals. So that's a little bit of the backstory. I don't know that Paul Waldman knows the backstory, but he certainly didn't provide it for his audience. And you won't expect, can't expect Hillary Clinton to want to provide that backstory. Because then again, we have to talk about her husband's policies back in the 1990s when it came to gun control. And I don't really think Hillary Clinton wants to go there right now. Anyway, we will also talk later in the program about Peter Shumlin, the governor of Vermont, who has some words for Hillary Clinton, blaming New York violence on Vermont firearms. We'll talk about that at the top of the hour. Right now, though, I want to take a time out. When we return to the program, Chip Eberhardt of Top Shot Academy. He was there in Springfield, Illinois yesterday at the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day. Gave a speech, and we'll talk with Chip about the crowd and the message that was delivered there in Illinois' capital. Stick around. We've got much more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this. From Arkansas State University, Dr. Eric Gilbert is with us. Dr. Gilbert, thank you for your time, sir.
Oh, my pleasure.
So you have a piece of the Chronicle for Higher Education right now. Stop worrying about guns in the classroom. They are already here. You are both a professor and an administrator there at Arkansas State, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. And why did you decide that you wanted to weigh in on this issue?
Well, I think the with Georgia and Texas both in the news, and there have been some changes in our laws governing these things. Campus carry is, of course, not legal in Arkansas, but it's been the rules have been changed so that people with concealed carry permits can now keep guns in their cars on campus as long as the guns don't leave the car. So it's kind of been in the news and something people have been thinking about, and it just seemed like the time was right to say something.
And your position seems to be, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that this is much ado about nothing?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a tempest in a teapot. I think the claims really on both sides of the debate are somewhat overblown. As I say in the article, I think there are probably already a fair number of guns on campus, at least in my part of the country. And for the bad things happen with those guns, but those are people who are bringing guns on campus illegally, often to do criminal sorts of things, or people who are discreetly bringing guns on campus not to do criminal things. And in general, the one group does criminal things with their guns, the other group doesn't. And I don't think adding another probably a relatively small number of people with concealed carry permits is really going to change the calculus all that much.
You point out that concealed carry holders are not a particularly violent lot. You say in Texas they commit crimes at about the same rate as police officers and at a lower rate than the general public. You also point out something that I think has largely been lost in this debate, and that is that concealed carry holders have to be at least 21, so most undergraduates will not be eligible. And a matter of fact, these are people who in many cases may already have their concealed carry license. This would simply be one place where they're not currently allowed to carry where they would be allowed to carry.
Yeah, that's correct. And, at a campus like ours where we have a lot of non-traditional students, probably a third of our undergraduates or maybe 25% of our undergraduates are over 21. But it's still, a minority of of the undergraduates.
And you also address a very common argument that I've seen from several professors. There was one professor at Georgia Tech who said, I will be afraid to teach the way I teach, and I think my students will be afraid to speak up if a concealed carry becomes the law, because someone could get upset and they could whip out their gun, and all of a sudden you've got people shooting at each other over a classroom discussion. And I'm glad to hear you say that you find this utterly implausible. I have to say I do too, Professor, because do you see a lot of fist fights right now breaking out in your class over disagreements in history or things like that?
No. And, you know, actually someone in the comments on that article actually pointed out that it, you know, he's been doing this for 25 years and nobody's hit him yet. So he assumes nobody's going to shoot him either. I think the probability of somebody losing their cool over, no matter how controversial something is, certainly that happens. People yell and scream. It doesn't happen very often, but it probably happens occasionally in classes. But I think the likelihood of someone shooting someone about something like that seems pretty remote.
Yeah, I mean,
that's not saying it couldn't happen, but you know, it seems pretty unlikely.
I mean, you say most of us complain that our students won't even read, and now we're worrying about them being so engaged that they might throw caution to the wind and start shooting. In other words, you're more concerned about the, dare I say, apathy from your students or the.
Well, that's not to sort of indict students and
sure.
their level of interest, but. Rather, you know, if you read the Chronicle of Higher Education a lot, there's far more concern about the lack of student engagement. You know, we've had this book, Academically Adrift, which talks about the even at elite institutions, students are increasingly unengaged with their course material. And so most of the discourse about this is about lack of student engagement, except in this context where people seem to talk about how engaged in emotional students are in their classes about content. And I don't doubt that there are classes where people get quite worked up, but if they're not throwing chairs at each other, they're probably not going to start shooting at each other.
Next hour here on NRA News Cam and Company, we're talking to Mayor Rick Austin down in Demarest, Georgia, where they have just given the okay for employees of the city who are concealed carry holders to carry while they are at work. I guess this is controversial somewhere. I don't know. I don't think it's very controversial there in Demarest, Georgia. But we'll talk with the mayor down there next year. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from Top Shot Academy. Chip Eberhardt is with us. Chip, how you doing, sir?
Hey, Cam. I'm well. How are you this fine day?
I am excellent. How was everything at the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day yesterday?
Outstanding. Even though we had really poor weather, I haven't been going the full 10 years, but I've been told this is the worst weather we've ever had. We still had a good turnout. I'm not real good at estimating, but I'd say there's definitely more than 3,000, less than 15,000, you know, kind of standard wild guess. But we should have some numbers coming up out pretty soon. But really good, really well organized. Big thanks to, the leadership of the ISRA as well as Belinda Rowe at Illinois Carry for really putting together an awesome event that really brought people together to, collectively and really functionally lobby, our legislators. Let them know that we're here. We're the constituents and we have a voice.
And so what was that message for lawmakers? Was there anything specific that, that y'all were talking about in terms of Illinois' gun laws?
Yeah, well, at a high level, we were talking about the fact that there's still way too many prohibitions. There's too many restrictions. We have over 26 locations that are prohibited just by the legislation. I mean, in contrast to like Utah, which only has 4, we're the most restrictive state. And, there's a lot of people that feel defeated before they even think about applying. They think, I can't carry anywhere. And there's so many myths around it, too. I remember once hearing a guy say, well, I know you can't carry anywhere they serve food, which is pretty ridiculous. But, so education is a problem. But the biggest problem, like I said, is on the legislative side. We've got we can't carry in rest areas. We can't carry while hunting. We can't carry one of the biggest ones. Can't carry while on public transit. I mean, can you imagine that, Cam?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the place where you're the most vulnerable. You're on public transportation. In your car, you can carry there. You can control where you go. But on public transportation, you're going through some pretty rough neighborhoods. You don't know who's going to get on and off the bus, the train. And you've got to, in order to get to work, because a lot of people in Chicago commute, with public transportation. In order to go to work, you've got to disarm yourself.
Absolutely. And, as well as I do, Chip, if you live in the suburbs, you live in the country, you probably have a vehicle, right? But if you live in the
right.
city, you may not. In fact, we are told all of the time, Chip, by our elected leaders in urban areas, don't own a car, go green, use public transportation. And now you're also told, you're going to have to give up your right of self-defense if you do so.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Not.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like I said, those are the fights. But even at the higher level, we've been having problems, you know, getting our bills through committee. They're afraid of us. They're really afraid of us. You know, Mike Madigan, you know, who's the Speaker of the House, he's terribly afraid of us. He's halting our bills in rules committees and other committees, and just they're not making it to the floor for debate. You know, his bills, you know, like he's got one he's behind, a special order protection. Let's say that let's say we live together and, you know, I get mad at you. Mm-hmm. I can go to the police department. I can just say, oh, he's got guns. Take him away. There's no due process. Just because I'm either a family member or we're living in the same household, I can go get an order of protection. Not because you did anything. Not because you threatened me. Not because you pulled out a gun. But just because I say, oh, he's got guns and I'm afraid, take him away. Strip his rights.
And that's the law right now in Illinois.
No, that's a proposal.
That's the proposal
that they're pushing. Yeah, we don't have that. Yeah, we're fighting it steadfast.
Yeah, very similar to what is on the books now in California, I believe.
Yeah, and that's you know, I think that's where Rahm and his cronies, you know, they're trying to do a lot of this California style gun control, which really, you know, gun control is the wrong thing. I mean, it's really people control.
Well, I mean, you know, and Chip, look, I mean, you know, we just watched your Freedom Safest Place spot. And you talk about parents putting their kids to bed to the sound of gunfire. And that really resonated with me because when I met my wife, she was a single mom in Camden, New Jersey, which was the murder capital of the United States at the time. And she did exactly that. I mean, and at some point you become numb. You don't even hear that sound in the background. It becomes so common. The idea that we're going to tackle Chicago's violence by, again, focusing on law-abiding gun owners, making it easier to take away people's legally owned firearms without due process, when the cause of Chicago's violence is a relatively small number of individuals who are perpetrating such misery on their communities, you know, I realize that the word offended gets overused a lot these days, Chip, but if I lived in one of these neighborhoods, I would be offended by proposals like this.
Yeah, as you should be. Like I said, it's not a gun crime problem. It's a crime problem. It's not a gun violence problem. It's a violence problem. Really, at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of youth violence too, and that comes down to it's a parenting problem. You know, there's so many. You know, not to go off on a tangent, but there's so many parents who are afraid to know what's in their kids' backpacks, what's in their rooms, what's in their minds. Those aren't parents. Those are roommates. You know, people have got to take responsibility for their actions, their kids' actions, and stop blaming law-abiding citizens who want nothing more than to defend themselves. And really, you know, I know you and myself and every gun owner I know hopes they never have to use it. We're
absolutely
not looking for a fight. We're looking to evade. We just want the ability to defend ourselves.
Absolutely. The human right of self-defense. Chip, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. Before we run out of time here, I got to ask you, were you the only person from the Chicago area there yesterday at iGold, or were there quite a few folks making the drive down from Chicago?
Quite a few folks making the drive down, and I even ran into a chief of staff from a Democratic legislator who said, well, I got my permit, and I came down for this.
Really?
Yes. From
the Chicagoland area.
From the Chicagoland area, from Rogers Park District. So I don't want to out him completely, but, yeah. So there was good representation all around.
You know, I'm glad to hear that. I hope, and I sincerely mean this, Chip, I hope one day that individual can, as a Democrat from Chicago, if he wants to, proudly say, you know what, I'm a concealed carry holder, and not have it cost him politically or professionally. We're not there yet. I understand we're not there yet. We've got some deeply entrenched anti-gun attitudes, but you know, despite what the appearances are, as you point out, there are a lot of people all across the political spectrum who understand and are exercising their right to keep and bear arms.
You're absolutely right. Thanks again for having me on the show.
Absolutely, Chip. Real pleasure, man. We'll talk again very soon. Thanks for what you do.
All right. Thank you.
Chip Eberhardt with us from Top Shot Academy there on NRA News, Cam and Company. I imagine that coming out as a Democratic chief of staff there in Chicago as a concealed carry holder would probably be like announcing yourself As a rock-ribbed supporter who owns a conservative supporter who owns a chalk at, let's say, Berkeley, probably not going to go over very well. But I hope, again, I do. I hope that one day people, regardless of where they fall on the political spectrum, because, again, regardless of where they fall on the political spectrum, they are exercising their right to keep and bear arms. We have conservative gun owners. We have independent gun owners. We have liberal gun owners. But it would be nice if we had two parties in this country where, again, across the board, coast to coast, you could declare yourself to be a gun owner, a concealed carry holder, someone who believes in the right of self-defense, and not have to worry about professional or political persecution for that. You know, to that end, actually, John Daniel Davidson of the Federalist is going to join us next hour. Why the political left, why the activist left can't help its intolerance. How about that? Plus, Mayor Rick Austin of Demarest, Georgia, okaying a policy that allows employees of the city who are concealed carry holders to carry while they are at work. Says it just makes sense. If the residents there can carry in these public buildings, why can't the employees? All right. When we come back, Hillary Clinton having a bit of a disagreement with one of her superdelegates right now over some of her comments regarding firearms. We'll fill you in on all of the details and more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information. It's all coming up right after a quick timeout, so stick around. Hour 2 of NRA News, Cam and Company, is coming up next. Speaking with Kara Richards about the NRA Women's Wilderness Escape. Kara, welcome to NRA News. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
I'll tell you what, I love the Women's Wilderness Escape. We were talking before we got on the air about what you guys do out at Raton at the Whittington Center. Love it there. And you've added some stuff, a weekend at Seven Springs, which is a beautiful facility up in Pennsylvania, and a weekend at Sig Sauer Academy. Man, oh, man, you guys got a lot going on. Tell us about it.
Yeah, we're really excited. The past year, we've been in the planning process with the Sig Sauer Academy. So this is a brand new event for 2016. And because the Seven Springs Resort and Whittington Center were such a big hit in 2015, we're also bringing back those two events.
How could it not be a big hit? Because you're picking great venues that are so diverse, going from Raton, New Mexico, and back to Pennsylvania, and then out to Sig Sauer Academy. It's awesome. So, Kara, tell folks who don't know, what is the NRA Women's Wilderness Escape? What's it all about?
Well, the Women's Wilderness Escape is for women ages 18 and older of all different experience levels. We cover a wide variety of shooting sports, so we try and, you know, cater to women that just want to do shotgun in Pennsylvania or pistol and rifle in New Hampshire. But if you want to do all five different disciplines, you can come out to the Whittington Center in Raton, New Mexico, and have a chance to do pistol, rifle, shotgun, muzzleloading, and archery.
So tell me, who is the typical woman, if there is a typical woman, Kara, who does this?
You know, we have ladies that are just 18 years old. Some are registered this year that aren't even turning 18 until the events happen. So we have people that are, you know, in their college early career stages, and then we also have had women up until their 80s attend the event. So we have a wide variety of women from all different backgrounds attending the event.
And Kara, why should a woman do this event? What you tell them, why should they come and do this?
It's a great way to meet other women that have like-minded you know, interests as you. You might be a pistol shooter, but you might realize that you actually enjoy shotgun more. So it really just gives you a taste of all the different shooting sports that we have to offer. So you might find a new passion, but love your old passion too. So it's a great way to meet people and also to find new hobbies.
Yeah, so I guess if you're an experienced shooter or a novice, anyone's appropriate for this program, it sounds like.
Yes, that's correct.
Speaking with Kara Richards with the NRA Women's Wilderness Escape. So we're talking about a week in Raton at the beautiful Whittington Center. What is it, Kara? Something like 35,000 acres. I mean, who's counting at that point, right?
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
5,000 acres of ranges out there. It's gorgeous. And then a week at the weekend at the Seven Springs Resort. If you've not been there in Pennsylvania, it's a beautiful resort up there. And then a weekend at the Six Hour Academy. This is great stuff. All right. So before we run out of time, how can people get more information about this wonderful program?
You can log on to our website, and the link is wwe.nra.org.
20 seconds left. This is your final chance to make a pitch. Why should women check out this wonderful program? Go ahead.
Okay. This is a once-in-a-lifetime experience that you will remember for the rest of your life, and you will build friendships that you've never had before. In keeping in contact with women from all over the country.
Awesome. You did such a great job. Kara Richards, NRA Women's Wilderness Escape. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Mayor Rick Austin of Demarest, Georgia, later in the hour on the city's new policy allowing employees of the city to carry on the job while they are at work if they are concealed carry holders. Already the public allowed to carry in these public buildings in Demarest, Georgia. So the proposal was put forth to let employees carry as well. John Daniel Davidson of the Federalist joins us later in the hour on why the activist left can't help its intolerance. Meanwhile, at Reason magazine, Jacob Sullum says that Hillary Clinton is blaming New York gun violence on Vermont. Perhaps another liar, liar, pantsuit on fire moment here for Hillary Clinton. In a private meeting with New York legislators on Monday, Jacob writes, Hillary Clinton reportedly claimed that Vermont, home of Bernie Sanders, is an important source of guns used by criminals in New York State. State Senator Tim Kennedy, Democrat from Buffalo, told Politico, quote, she said it's going to be coming out in the very near future that many of the catastrophes that have taken human lives in the state of New York have been the product of guns coming over the border from Vermont. Kennedy said, that's the first I heard it. I think it caught everybody's attention, and we're looking forward to learning more about it. Jacob Sullum says the reason why Kennedy hasn't heard about this before is because it's not true. Yeah. In 2014, according to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, there were a total of 55 guns seized in New York State that were traced back to an original retail sale in Vermont. 55. That represented 1.2% of the 4,585 traces in which the location of the original sale could be identified. Vermont ranking 15th. Among the states where the guns were originally sold. You know the number one state, by the way? The number one state for a New York recovery of a firearm. They pick up the gun in New York. They run a trace on it. Number one state for where that gun originated. New York State. New York State. In 2014, there were 1,397 firearms originally sold in New York, recovered in New York. Now, keep in mind, not every gun that is recovered and traced is a gun that's used in crime, and not every gun that's used in crime is recovered and traced by the ATF. 1,397 compared to 371 from Pennsylvania, 395 from Virginia, 279 from North Carolina, 292 from Florida, 49 from California, 103 from Texas, and 55 again from Vermont. By far, the number one source state for firearms recovered in New York State is New York State. Now, Jacob Sullum says, maybe Tim Kennedy, that senator, misunderstood Clinton, but probably not. Assemblyman Kevin Cahill had a similar recollection. He told Political, quote, she said that many of the guns that are found to be involved in crimes in the state are found to have had their origins in Vermont. The implication was just that many of the guns that are involved in crimes in the state come from Vermont. That was the implication that I got. Sullivan says even if Clinton's claim was close to accurate, it would prove absolutely nothing about Sanders' views on gun control, which presumably are what she was trying to impugn by implication. Yesterday, Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin, who is a Hillary Clinton supporter, described her claim about his state as the sort of lie politicians feel compelled to tell when they run for office. Quote, it's campaign season. Therefore, things that are sometimes said by all the candidates that sometimes aren't entirely accurate. I would just say this, he said. I think you'd have a hard time convincing Vermonters that New York's crime problems are coming from Vermont. Uh-huh. According to, here's the thing. You would have a hard time convincing Vermonters of that. You should also have a hard time convincing New Yorkers of that, because it's not true. And so here's Peter Shumlin, superdelegate for Hillary Clinton, saying, you know, it's campaign season. Everybody lies during campaign season. And, you know, this is a lie with a purpose. She's lying to ding Bernie Sanders. And, you know, she's lying to the people of New York. Now, the people of Vermont, they'll tell you, no, there's no way. But, you know, it's campaign season. What are you going to do? I don't know. Tell the truth. Be honest. That's a start. According to WCAX, the CBS station of Burlington, Shumlin also said that there is no question that heroin in Vermont comes from out of state and is often brought in by New Yorkers. Huh. I mean, heroin's illegal everywhere. It is also more widely available and cheaper than it was 20 years ago, according to the DEA, because of the efforts of the drug cartels. Yeah. You know, interestingly enough, and this is another area in which the media doesn't necessarily feel like covering the story a lot. Drug overdose deaths in this country are at record highs. Violent crime at or near historic lows. I saw a tweet earlier today from somebody with the Brookings Institution, which is not, by the way, a bastion of pro-Second Amendment thought. But he noted a Gallup, I think it was Gallup, it might have been Pew, survey showing that Americans' concerns, that's a new Gallup poll, reports that Americans' concern about crime is at a 15-year high, when in fact, he says, crime rates are at historic lows. Hillary Clinton is out there talking about the epidemic of gun violence in this country, when violent crime, again, at or near 40-year lows. Certainly that's not the case for every city, right? When we talk about what's going on in Chicago, we can talk about what happened in Baltimore, Maryland last year. Thankfully, the numbers appear to be not as bad this year. But we know, you know, violent crime is up in Los Angeles, California. Again, hopefully these are short-term blips and not the start of a long-term trend, because for 20 years, violent crime has been decreasing in this country. Again, near all-time historic lows. In the this drop in crime started in the early 1990s. You go back and you look at the crime trends throughout the 20th century. There was another drop in crime, a crime trough, as the criminologists call it, that started in the early 1930s, mid-1930s, and ran through the early 1960s. And then violent crime started going up again. And up throughout the 1960s, after the Gun Control Act of 1968 was passed, that didn't do anything to stem the rise in violent crime. D.C. banning handguns in 76 didn't do anything to stem the rise in violent crime. Chicago banning handguns in 83 didn't do anything. Violent crime keeps going up until the mid-90s, when it starts to decline again. And for 20 years, we have seen that rate go down. I would note, by the way, at a time in which we've seen millions of Americans become concealed carry holders. You know, again, the anti-gun dogmatic belief of more guns equals more crime has been disproven for a couple of decades now. But Hillary Clinton doesn't want to talk about that. She wants to talk about gun control. The media, by and large, doesn't want to talk about the real crime trends. Not when the phrase, if it bleeds, it leads, is part of the standard lexicon of a television newsroom. They will always be reporting on crime. Rarely will they be reporting the context of these crimes. And so I wondered earlier today how many members of the media will look at that poll and think to themselves, do we bear any responsibility for this disconnect between what our audience assumes and what is really the case here? You know, it's not just that concern over violent crime is up among voters, while crime itself is at or near historic lows. Most Americans don't know that crime has been dropping for 20 years. Most Americans don't. Most Americans think that crime is about the same as it has been, or that it's going up. Again, I think the media bears some culpability for that disconnect. We certainly talk about this fact on the program, but I got to be honest with you, I don't hear a lot of other media outlets talking about it. Even when the FBI crime numbers come out twice a year, you get the numbers in June. They're generally for the previous year, and then you get numbers towards the end of the year for the first 6 months of the calendar year that we're in. So in June of this year, we'll get the numbers for 2015. Towards the end of the year, we'll get the numbers for January through June of this year, the preliminary numbers. For years now, there has been an opportunity in big, bold headlines to print violent crime down again. Crime at lowest level since 1970. Crime at lowest level since 1960. Homicides dropped to an all-time low. There are plenty of papers around the country who could have written those stories. Big, bold headlines. Maybe you get it at page A12. Maybe it's a 30-second reader on CNN. It won't be on your local television news. Odds are, anyway. This, not just good news, this fantastic news. This really important news goes unreported. And instead, the media is more than happy to talk about the epidemic of violent crime when crime is going down. They are not so happy to talk about the epidemic of drug overdoses, I have noticed. In Virginia in 2014, we had, I want to say it was 331 homicides. It's around 330. We had over 725 drug overdoses. I've not seen that headline anywhere in the state of Virginia. So I got to say, I mean, not only is this a false argument by Hillary Clinton trying to blame Vermont's gun laws for New York's violent crime, but the whole anti-gun argument that Hillary Clinton is launching here, again, aiming all of her policy proposals at law-abiding citizens, not the violent criminals, doesn't even mention violent criminals. It's the NRA, it's gun manufacturers, it's the gun lobby, which is you if you're an NRA member. The way that Hillary Clinton proposes to make us safer is to go after the people who are not committing violent crimes. That ultimately is her answer. If we do more of what they did in New York State with the SAFE Act, if we did more of what they did in Maryland with the Maryland Firearm Safety Act, if our laws look more like California, where, again, violent crimes are going up in L.A., but let's not talk about that. If we just have more laws, more restrictions on those who actually try to obey the laws, then we will see violent crime go down. That's her argument. Coming up in about an hour, when we have our hero of the day and our deal of the day and our good guy of the day, we're going to revisit this. Because Hillary Clinton had an op-ed in one of the Pennsylvania papers. And she talks about the victims of violence in Harrisburg. She says the names of these individuals, but she doesn't really talk about who they were. And as a matter of fact, several of them could qualify for our deals of the day. Because just like we've talked about in this program time and time again, you look what's happening in Chicago right now. We're about 6% of the city's population is really at risk of being the victim of a violent crime and also committed a violent crime. Where most of the homicide suspects and homicide victims have previous criminal histories. When the more people that you know within that 6%, the more likely you are to end up a victim of gang violence. You know, again, this is the primary, both the primary offenders and the primary victims of violence, not just in Chicago, but in city after city. A small group of individuals compared to the general population. And Hillary Clinton's big, bold idea is to ignore everything that we know about who is committing violent crimes and who are being victimized by those individuals. To ignore all of that. And to say the answer lies in going after the NRA. The answer lies in going after the gun manufacturers. The answer lies not in going after, again, that small number of individuals who are committing violent crimes, but going after the 400 million firearms. Going after the, 90 million American gun owners. We haven't even talked about the Constitution. But we'll talk more about this coming up at the top of Hour 3. When we return to the program, John Daniel Davidson of the Federalist, why the activist left cannot help its intolerance. Stick around. We've got more. NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Bill Poole, he is Managing Director, NRA Education and Training Division. Bill, let's talk about the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course. I understand some of it's now available online. Tell us about it.
Yes, John. It's called blended learning. That means that part of the course is online. It's about a 7.5-hour online training section that students can complete in the comforts of their own home on their own schedule. And then once they've completed the online or the e-learning module, then they can contact an NRA-certified instructor who will take them to the range and check out their skills, make sure their safe gun handling is at its top, and that their marksmanship skills is just as good as it needs to be.
So this is the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course, which is, Bill, such a great course and such a great thing. You guys have kind of jiggered things up a little bit there to make it easier for people to do, right?
It is easier, but I don't want anybody to think that that means that it's shorter or less comprehensive. It's about 7.5 hours of seat time when you take the e-learning module, and then about another 5 hours of time when you go shooting. But the good news is the shooting portion can be all done in one day, in half a day, and so it's going to meet the needs of our students' schedules much better than we've been able to do in the past.
I love it. So then get the book learning part done, then get out there to the range with an NRA-certified instructor and finish it all up. It's a great idea, this blended learning course. So, Bill, how can folks get more information about this? How can they sign up? How do they do it?
First step step is go to our webpage. It's onlinetraining.nra.org, and I hope they all do it today.
Why should folks check out the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course?
It is one of the most vibrant, robust e-learning training courses they're ever going to encounter. There's video, there are 3D pictures. You can listen to it. You can read it. I mean, we've used every modality teachers know how to use. It's an excellent course.
Couldn't have said it better myself, Bill Poole. Thank you so much, sir.
I'm a mom, a business owner, and a patriot, but I am not a politician. A few years ago, I founded a nonprofit to defend voters' rights and stop election fraud. We exposed corruption, so the corruptors wanted me silenced. The IRS, FBI, ATF, OSHA, and a U.S. congressman turned my life upside down. Their investigations were invasive, abusive, relentless, and political. They demanded every social media message I'd ever posted, the name of every group I'd ever spoken to, and every word I spoke. I was supposed to give up, but I am not a victim. I'm an American, and I will not stand by and watch while our freedoms are picked off. An attack on one right is an attack on every right. So, I fight. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
You know the threat is real. You sit in meetings with advisors and operatives who tell you there could be Islamic sleeper cells in every major American community. You know the southern border is a welcome mat for terrorists to enter our towns and neighborhoods at will. You know about their plots to kill us in our shopping malls, our sports stadiums, and our office buildings. You won your office by talking like a champion of freedom. Now it's time to act like one. Pass a national right to carry law that guarantees my constitutional right to defend myself, my family, and my fellow Americans anywhere inside our borders. And make sure the enemies of freedom know the power of freedom. No law-abiding American should be forced to face evil with empty hands. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back. Thanks again for being a part of this edition of NRA News. Cam and Company, still to come on the program, Mayor Rick Austin of Demarest, Georgia, where the city has okayed city employees who are concealed carry holders carrying while they are at work. Again, citizens there in Demarest, Georgia can walk into these public buildings with their concealed firearms. So the thinking is, why not the employees as well? Now, I do want to welcome to the program right now, writing at the Federalist, John Daniel Davidson joins us. John, how you doing, sir?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. You've got a piece, Why the Activist Left Cannot Help Its Intolerance. And you say that defacing monuments is an age-old tactic meant to suppress speech, intimidate political enemies. We see this with, you know, the Taliban. We see this with ISIS. You see this with all kinds of totalitarian regimes. And now we're seeing it here in the United States among the activist left. And the latest target, you say, is elementary schools?
Yeah, here in Austin, actually. I live in Austin, Texas, and there's a case just recently. An Austin school board decided to it was going to rename Robert E. Lee Elementary School. This has been, you know, part of a national debate about schools and monuments and other things that have been named for Civil War figures, and particularly generals in the Confederacy and political figures in the Confederacy. So, you know, last year you saw the removal of the Jefferson Davis statue from the University of Texas campus.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really kind of a movement that began at state houses and campuses, and now it's sort of trickled down to elementary schools.
In essence, this is, and what's fascinating to me about this as a lover of history, John, you know, we just got through with the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. And by the way, our president never commemorated this. He didn't show up at the anniversary of Gettysburg. Didn't show up at the anniversary of Appomattox. You know, there was no real public commemoration or recognition of
That's
these
right.
events. And then, you know, now it's almost like we've got past that 150-year mark, and now it's like, you know what, we really don't like this part of history. Let's just go ahead and destroy it. And here's what bothers me is that a nation should never, you should never ignore your history. It might make you uncomfortable. You might not like it. But you shouldn't ignore it. You shouldn't pretend that it didn't exist, because that's when really bad things happen, when you just, you know, just discard the story of how we got here.
Yeah, and it's actually a shame, because there's such a great opportunity for education and for to raise awareness about our history with the 150th anniversary of Gettysburg, with the 150th anniversary of Appomattox. And I really feel like it was an opportunity that was lost. And instead of, you know, having a national dialogue about the importance of the Civil War and understanding kind of the complexity of the post-Civil War settlement and how we kind of continued as one nation, instead we have this identity politics debate about minority students feeling unsafe on campuses that bear the names of Confederate generals. And it really was a huge distraction and a huge lost opportunity. But I think that you're right. It points to a cultural problem that we have in this country, that we don't understand the past and we don't appreciate it
well,
the way we need to.
And, you know, I mean, you look at – can you imagine, honestly, though, can you imagine the president at Gettysburg – or at Appomattox, talking about binding up the nation's wounds, when
right.
you know I think the president is more than happy to be a part of the sniping, to be a part of the partisanship, to exacerbate the problem. I honestly it would have been there would have been a lot of intellectual dissonance, I think, for the president to talk about things like that. I mean, you read Lincoln's second inaugural, where he talks about malice towards none and charity towards all, while the nation's in the middle of a civil war, right? While hundreds of thousands of Americans have lost their lives, he's talking about how do we put this back together again? And, you know, I don't think Barack Obama is interested in putting it back together again right now.
Well, the language of reconciliation and calling on the nation to bind up its wounds and come together and be unified and to overcome our divisions does not serve the Obama administration's political interests. There's a reason that this administration has been intentionally divisive and taken opportunities like this to be divisive, and that's because it serves its political interests. The coalition that brought Barack Obama into the White House is a coalition built on identity politics and pitting groups against each other, and you know, so it's no surprise that Obama did not want to use these opportunities to bring the nation together. His administration has intentionally fomented dissent and sort of acrimony and in-group fighting. That is sort of a broadly speaking, the political strategy of the left. Their coalition consists of, of different identity groups that the party serves, the Democratic Party serves. So, that is consistent with what the modern American left has become. I think we see that more and more. And the result is, you know, more divisions and more acrimony. And especially when it comes to things like monuments and the names of schools and the names of streets and bridges and stuff, you know, that's history. And people are tied to it, sometimes in very personal ways.
Absolutely. But as you point out in your piece, it goes beyond just the monuments and names of streets to now. It goes to hairstyles. It goes to cultural
That's
appropriation.
Right.
You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm dating myself here, John, but I'm trying to figure out how the idea of cultural appropriation can coexist with the idea of a melting pot society.
It can't. I mean, if we didn't have cultural appropriation, we wouldn't have rock and roll. They're two names for the same thing. The idea of America is that you would have different cultures and different groups of people coming together, and their customs and their their habits would mix together and would create new things, you know, and that kind of dynamism has been part of one of the strengths of our country. But you see on the left is sort of a retrenchment. They don't want cultures or groups to mix. They want to parcel things out and keep things separated. And so even something as innocuous, you mentioned hairstyles, that was a part of the article where a student at the University of San Francisco accosted another student, a black student, accosted a white student in the hall for having dreadlocks, saying you're culturally appropriating a hairstyle, a black hairstyle, and that's offensive to me. And it was actually, it became a physical altercation as well. So you're seeing kind of an intolerance for diversity being fomented in our colleges and universities, and it's a huge problem.
It is. So I was reading a book today, and I ran across this quote by Upton Sinclair talking about the Intercollegiate Socialist Society, which he founded, co-founded in 1905. And he said that, quote, this is, again, 1905, since the professors would not educate the students, it was up to the students to educate the professors. And as soon as I read that, John Davidson, I thought, man, that is what's happening now. You've got that same attitude, right? You've got people who are paying $60,000 a year to attend a school who say, yeah, I should be teaching. I'm the real educated person right here. You know nothings in the faculty. You shut up and listen to us for a little bit.
Well, you put your finger right on it, and you rightly hearken back to the turn of the last century. You know, a lot of the progressive ideas that we're seeing come to full flower now got started in the early 20th century. You know, this is not only, you know, some of the ideas about international relations that began with the administration of Woodrow Wilson, but a lot of the ideas about education and about what a university should be and, you know, what the different roles should be between students and professors. Those ideas, you know, are not new, but they've taken a long time to percolate through the culture. And now we're seeing kind of the fruits of those ideas bearing out in different ways in society.
So, you know, you talk about why the left can't help its intolerance, why it eventually has to eat itself. And you provide a couple of these examples, not only of the incident at San Francisco State University, but you say that the National Union of Students LGBT campaign passed a motion saying that the G in LGBT need to go away because they don't face oppression the way other members of the LGBT community do. And so they want to abolish representatives for gay men in the National Union of Students LGBT campaign. We've seen at Yale University, professors who are, you know, they're on the left, and they're attacked by their students for improper thought. The revolution is sort of eating its own on campus. Why is that? Why is it not just that the left is intolerant towards those it views on the right, but it is perhaps even more intolerant of those who are on the left?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to suppress the urge to indulge in a little bit of Schadenfreude when you see this stuff happening on the left. You know, as a conservative, seeing this stuff happen on the left. But the reason is that there is a hierarchy of victimhood on the progressive left, and being a victim means having power. And so, you know, if you can be the most victimized group or the most victimized individual, then it gives you leverage over other groups, even among the left. You know, the structure of left-wing politics and left-wing, you know, sort of cultural philosophy is, you know, competing interest groups. And, you know, the jockeying for power among those interest groups relies to a great extent on being a victim. So anytime that you can assert your victimhood over another, you can gain the upper hand. And so you saw that with the LGBT group. You see it. There was a story in the New York Times last year about an all-women's college. I can't remember the name of it, but they objected to the election of multicultural affairs officer of a of a woman who is transgender and now identifies as a man because she is a white woman, and now that she identifies as a white man, the women at this all-women's college thought it was inappropriate that a white man would be the multicultural affairs director. And so they, you know, protested her election to that office, and she had to give up the job. So, it's, like I said, it's on the one hand, it, maybe it's funny to conservatives this is happening. On the other hand, it's very dangerous. It's a very dangerous thing because they're not going to be confined to the left.
Yeah, I don't think it's too funny anymore. I don't know if you've seen the story that's come out today out of Tampa, Florida, but apparently in Spanish class for middle school students, 7th and 8th grade, the Spanish teacher handed out this this form. How much privilege do you have? Circle the boxes that apply to you. Have you heard about this, John?
I have not.
Oh, you're going to love this. So here are the categories. Race, white, Hispanic, black, Asian, Middle Eastern. White at the top, obviously, for the most privilege, right? I think this goes in order of most to least privilege. Skin color, white or light, brown or black or dark. Religion, Christian, Jewish, atheist, Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim, or Sikh. By the way, I'm sure the Muslims and the Sikhs love just being a, you know, it's the same thing, just Muslim slash Sikh, whatever, you know, no difference. you could choose the 7th or 8th graders between being a male, female, or intersex. That was the sex category. Then there was the gender category of cisgendered, transgendered, or genderqueer. Then there was the sexual orientation category of straight, homosexual, gay or lesbian, bisexual, asexual, or pansexual. And then there was the disability category of abled, mentally disabled, or physically disabled. And the 7th and 8th graders were supposed to circle which applied to them so that they could calculate their privilege quotient, I guess, or the teacher could calculate their privilege quotient. So, you know, if this was cute and amusing and ha-ha, look at the snowflakes, stories like this just popping up in an average middle school in an average school district somewhere, and the principal says, we don't know how this happened, you know, this all of a sudden becomes a much less amusing when you see stories like this.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think it's telling. I think you said this happened in a Spanish class.
Uh-huh.
You know, one of the ironies about multiculturalism is that it doesn't actually produce very much knowledge about other cultures. It would be one thing if multiculturalism expressed itself in our school system by a profusion of foreign language learning and the production of a bunch of students who graduate with two or three languages that they're able to speak and write. But that is not what multiculturalism has produced. It produces a very shallow level of appreciation, quote unquote, for culture without any corresponding knowledge of cultures. So that, you know, it really serves to raise awareness of bigotry or assumptions of bigotry on the part of mostly white students towards other groups. And in that, it is mostly a political thing. It is part of a political program. It's not really about cultures per se or languages. And that's why you see this happening in a Spanish class rather than, you know, Spanish language instruction, which is, of course, is a good thing.
Yeah, the questions weren't even in Spanish, John. I mean, that's, you know, they couldn't even get the questions about privilege in Spanish. I mean, that's just, it, you know, and I would like to see, I know that there have been some parents who complain, but I really do hope that the next PTA meeting, the next school board meeting, I hope that those are packed to the gills with parents because, you know, this is how you push back. Is you get involved. You can't be apathetic. You can't say, I'm just going to tune all this stuff out. No, you have to start arguing about the importance of free speech. You have to start arguing about the importance of knowing your history and not running away from it. You know, because otherwise you've got it doesn't matter if they're not very large in numbers. They're very motivated. They're very active. They're very connected and they're very loud. And unless they get some intellectual pushback, they'll have their way.
Yeah, you will be made to care, even if you don't care right now.
Well, listen, John, I appreciate you coming to the program, sir. It is always a pleasure. I hope we can do this again soon.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
You bet. John Daniel Davidson joined us writing at the Federalist on NRA News, Cam and Company. How about that quote by Upton Sinclair, by the way? 1905. See, all these snowflakes think that they're so special. They're so unique. Nothing like this has ever happened in the history of the world before. Wrong. 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 The Intercollegiate Socialist Society, by the way, which was founded by, among others, Upton Sinclair. Jack London was the first president. I mean, this is a big deal on college campuses. And again, this is pre-Bolshevik Revolution in the Soviet Union. This is about bringing the ideas of Karl Marx and socialism to the college campus because, again, as Upton Sinclair said in 1905, if the professors aren't educating the students, then it's up to the students to educate the professors. And so you had this blossoming of a movement that kind of reached its peak on campus in, I think it was 1935. The National Student Union, which was one of these offshoots of the campus left back then, staged a basically a strike on campus. And 500,000 college students, which was about a third of the college students in the United States at the time, 500,000 of them swore that they would never fight to defend this country, swore that they would never put on a uniform, that they would never go to war for the United States. Reality, as Jim Garrity said last hour, always wins. And you know, a lot of those college students in 1935 who thought that capitalism was done and gone, who thought that the Soviet Union was the nation that was on the rise, that there was a better, more humane way of living that was taking place in the Soviet Union, and that they didn't want to be a part of that fight regarding, you know, fascism and communism. They just wanted to stay out of it, work to adopt socialist policies here. A lot of those men ended up dying for this country just a few years later, because reality has a way of catching up to you. Reality has a way of catching up to events. And it's real easy to say, you know what, I'm never going to put on the uniform. I'm never going to fight for this country, when you haven't been called to do so. Thankfully, again, most of those men answered the call when it came. I'm an optimist. I think that even among the snowflakes, if called upon, would rise to the occasion. I hope so anyway. But right now, we just seem to be in a race to the bottom here on a lot of college campuses. All right, we're going to take a timeout. When we return to the program, Mayor Rick Austin in Demarest, Georgia, is going to join us on the program. I was talking with Michael Graham in Atlanta earlier today, and Michael brought up this story of Demarest, Georgia, changing its policy to allow city employees who are concealed carry holders to carry while they are at work. We will get to the bottom of this, discuss some of the details with Mayor Rick Austin right after a quick timeout. Stick around. We'll be back with more right after this. Right now, you know, we have a good guy segment on the program each and every day. Well, here is a real-life good guy. Major Ed Polito is with us from the Folds of Honor Foundation. Major, it's good to see you again, sir.
Man, what a great day to be an American.
Yes, yeah. Sir. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. I'm just excited. Look, at when you get to come here, this is freedom right here.
Right.
And you get to see all of the great things that are, all the great people, all the great items that are here, and certainly the hardware, man. I tell you what, it doesn't get better than that, and this is about the USA, baby.
Yeah,
in Vegas.
That's right. So tell me, for folks who haven't been able to catch you on the program before, those few Americans out there who still are unaware of the Folds of Honor Foundation, what does this organization do?
Well, the Folds of Honor Foundation was started by Major Dan Rooney, and as a co-founder of the organization, I've been with Major Dan on this mission for about 8 years. We give scholarships to the families that have fallen and wounded, but we've awarded over 10,000 scholarships. This year, we'll probably do another 2,500 to deserving military families, honoring the sacrifice, educating the legacy, and providing healing and support for these wounded service members that come back and are disabled, and that they need that hope and that support. And I think, you know, NRA News has been with us from day one, and, you know, we've got so many great sponsors that are part of it. Here, just in the show, you know, Colt Bushnell, got 511 Tactical down there. We're going to do a book signing at 2:30 this afternoon at the 511 Tactical booth, and we're just spreading the message about freedom and sacrifice and the Folds of Honor.
You know, and it's so important, especially for those of us who never wore the uniform and we never served. We have, I think, an obligation to help those who have. And, you know, I never wore the uniform, but my dad was in the Navy in World War II. My brother was in the Army during Desert Storm, was in Korea at the time. And I've lived around military families, and I've gotten to see firsthand not only how the soldier or the sailor or the airman, how they are impacted, but how their entire families are making sacrifices each and every day. And when we're talking about our wounded warriors, you know, those families, they're going through so much that it's easy for us to forget, right? We don't see the news stories every day anymore about our soldiers in Iraq or Afghanistan. In fact, our special ops guys, you know, they work very quietly. And
Correct.
So we're not supposed to see the headlines, but they're there and they are serving, and we need to serve them. So what can we do to get involved with Folds of Honor?
Well, people can go to foldsofhonor.org and get involved. They can also do a lot of buy the products that we have out here. The other thing I will tell you is that as you serve this great nation, and as I put on the nation's uniform, lost my leg, almost lost my life, I always think about, you know what, I did what I did to preserve freedom in this nation. And for all of us in this nation to have everything that we've got, to live and have a great quality of life. And you just explained that to us, to your listenership. You know, it's about honoring that sacrifice, but more importantly, about making sure that around the world that they know the United States of America is nobody to be messing around with. Because at the end of the day, our people stand up for freedom.
Now, okay, so to that end, I want to ask you something as Major Ed Polito, not with the Folds of Honor Foundation, but just Major Ed Polito for a second. How concerned are you that that America's enemies are starting to get a different message, that maybe we can be pushed around a little bit?
Well, I got to tell you that we cannot sit around and let people push us around. And I am a big advocate. In my book, Warrior for Freedom, I wrote about Ronald Reagan and his message to the world that, you know what, not only are you going to tear that wall down, but if you do something and you get out of line, we're going to bust you up. And I got to tell you, that's the way I look at things. You know, we cannot sit around in this world that's so negative with ISIS doing what they're doing. And then, of course, them kind of infiltrating our country and then this refugee problem and all of this. And our leadership, our poor leadership, not understanding that at the end of the day, it's not about saying that individuals can't come here and follow the American dream. It's about making sure that when you come here, you learn not only our language, our customs, but you live as an American. And I got to tell you, the culture, I'm Colombian and Puerto Rican. My father was an immigrant. I truly understand that the red, white, and blue shines bright because people like him, a Vietnam-era vet, took that oath of office to love his country, to love his family, and to have faith in God. And I think that's the elements of who we are in this nation.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart next hour, Rick Unger of Steel and Unger on Sirius XM POTUS, plus Hero of the Day, sponsored by Agcor Defense. Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day. Right now, I want to welcome the mayor of Demarest, Georgia. Mayor Rick Austin is with us. Mayor, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing super today, Cam. How are you?
I am fantastic. I want to thank you for coming on the program. I was talking with our friend Michael Graham, or my friend Michael Graham in Atlanta. I don't know if you've had the chance to meet Michael yet, but he actually alerted me to what's going on there in Demarest. You all have had a recent change to the laws there in the community, correct?
Well, we made an adjustment to our employee policy here in the city of Demarest is what we did. Back in 2014, Georgia passed what is known as the Safe Carry Protection Act of 2014, and buried deep in that legislation was a clause that allowed those that have a concealed weapon permit to be able to carry into government buildings where ingress is not monitored. That runs counter to virtually every public policy, every personnel policy in every government that's in the state. I've known about it for a while. It's been mulling on my mind for the last couple of months, and I just decided to rectify that. I need my citizens, my employees, to be able to have the same rights that everyone else in the state has, because our employee policy simply said that they couldn't carry.
So you could have residents there of Demarest, they could walk in and they could be carrying, but the employees could not.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, you know, as I was talking with Michael about this, he brought up, he said, well, why do the employees need to do this? Why do they need to carry? And I pointed out, you know, look, practically speaking, likely what we're going to be talking about are people who keep that firearm on them rather than lock it up in their car while they are at work.
That's right.
It won't be an issue unless they, you know, would ever be faced with that, God forbid, awful situation where they would have to use that firearm for self-defense inside that city building. Thankfully, those things are rare, Mayor, but they are not unheard of, unfortunately, in this country.
No, they're not unheard of. You can just take a look at what happened in San Bernardino, California, just recently, where you had a governmental gathering for a Christmas party, and we all know what the outcome of that was. Cam, I'll tell you that this was as much about the 14th Amendment as it is about the Second Amendment, and I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I'm a life member of the NRA. But the 14th Amendment guarantees us all that we have equal protection of the law. And because certain citizens were allowed to carry in government buildings, and we by our policies and other governments by their policies are preventing state employees and local employees of state of local governments to be able to carry, we're violating their 14th Amendment.
Talking again with Mayor Rick Austin of Demarest, Georgia. So what has the reaction been there in the community, Mr. Mayor?
It's been extraordinarily positive. Of course, we've had some negative, but not that's been minor and few and far between. Most everyone has been extraordinarily positive. And I was asked a question by Atlanta TV station yesterday, how many of your employees do you think will utilize this opportunity? And I said, I don't know. It could be zero. It could be all of them. But that's regardless to me. At the end of the day, I want them to have the same opportunities that every other Georgian has, and that is to be able to carry inside a government building.
So you've not seen any recall petitions started against you or anything like that?
I doubt that's going to happen.
is Demarest, is that NRA country, Mr. Mayor?
It's absolutely NRA country. We're nestled in the northeast Georgia mountains. We're about 75 miles northeast of Atlanta. It's a quiet town. It's a great place to raise a family. We've got a lot of stuff going on here, but we're nice and small, and it's definitely NRA country.
So I want to ask you. You mentioned that you're an NRA life member. What is your background? How did you get into politics? And I'm guessing that being the mayor of Demarest, Georgia, probably I don't know if that's a full time. I know it's a full time job in terms of the duties, but maybe not in terms of the salary. So what can we learn more about you, Mr. Mayor?
Sure, absolutely. When I was in college, I was at a diversion path in my life. I was either going to law school or I was going to be a biologist, and I chose to be a biologist, and so I'm a PhD college professor. We can talk about that at some other point in time. But, I teach by day, and I've been in politics now for about 14 years. I started as a planning commissioner, then county commissioner from there. Did a stint in the state legislature as the House representative for District 10 in the state of Georgia. Came back home and am now mayor presently of the city of Demarest. It's a full-time job with part-time pay, that's for sure. But, I enjoy serving. I enjoy serving my community, number one. Number two, I enjoy solving problems. And this gives me a great outlet to do so. And somebody said you must love it, and I do. It's a great opportunity every day to see a problem such as the one that we just solved Tuesday night bring a common sense government solution. We don't have enough common sense in government these days. Bring a common sense solution to the people and take care of our employees at the same time.
Talking again with the mayor of Demarest, Georgia, Mayor Rick Austin. And, unfortunately, Mr. Mayor, we're almost out of time here, but I would love to have you back and talk about you being a college professor here. I've got to ask you while we do have a moment. We've got the campus carry bill on Governor Deal's desk there in Georgia, House Bill 859. As a college professor yourself, what are your thoughts on campus carry? We hear a lot of arguments that college students are too drunk, they're too irresponsible. Professors worried that students would lash out and pull a gun in class. Does any of that ring true to you at all?
Well, you hear those arguments a lot, but you and I both know that that no matter where you're in higher education, academia and higher education tends to be left-leaning, and so oftentimes you get those same types of arguments that center from those left leanings. If that bill were sitting on my desk, I'd sign it. I'm in strong support of campus carry. I think that we don't give our younger generation, our college generation, enough credit to be able to carry. You know, obviously we have laws here in the state of Georgia that they would have to be 21 and they'd have to go through the same process that I had to go through in order to be able to conceal carry. And you know, I trust my students. I think that there's a lot of wisdom that is there. And you know, when I was in Atlanta, Georgia State University is just down the street from the Atlanta Capitol, and I came out one night, late one night, it wasn't that late, 7:30, and a college professor had been mugged by three individuals, and they took his briefcase. Now, probably all they got out of there was some papers that needed to be graded, but, you know, it gives a prime example that professors and students ought to have the right to be able to defend themselves if they're faced with such a frightening event, and I strongly support it.
Well, listen, Mr. Mayor, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It was a pleasure talking with you, and let's have you back soon.
Absolutely. All you have to do is call.
All right. Thank you, sir. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Absolutely. Thanks, Cam.
Mayor Bye-bye. Rick Austin joins us from Demarest, Georgia. How about that? Fascinating. I got to say, I love the service, you know. Again, state representative, mayor of a small town, I don't want to say legislative activities, but, you know, serving on the county commission. That's a great story. We need more Americans who are willing to do those things. I'll tell you what, hopefully we have time next year as well, because I want to talk about, another, individual in Pennsylvania. Who this country could use more of. We'll try to talk about that. Maybe a special good guy story next hour. Also, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart going to join us. Rick Unger of Steel and Unger will be with us on the program as well. The website U.S. Uncut with a headline, Hillary Clinton using Sandy Hook victims as political props just backfired completely. Amanda Girard says some of her supporters are even switching sides. Clinton's campaign has been attacking the gun issue since last night, casting Bernie Sanders as a friend of gun manufacturers and Hillary Clinton as a staunch advocate of gun control. But that line of attack completely backfired after her campaign team tweeted a political attack at Sanders using the children killed in Sandy Hook as a political football. We'll talk about that as well. Stick around. More of NRA News, Cam and Company is coming up right after this. Speaking with Peter Churchborn with NRA Outdoors. Peter, welcome to NRA News. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Now, Peter, we've got a lot to cover here. In NRA Outdoors, we have the outdoor schools. There's a long-range school, wilderness school, wilderness survival, that is three-gun introduction, tactical carbine, defensive handgun, so much neat stuff. Can I sign up for every one of them? Is that okay?
Yes, sir. We'd love to have you.
Well, tell us first, what are the NRA outdoor schools all about? How did this whole program get going?
Well, you know, this started out of necessity, where NRA Outdoors was originally a booking service for the NRA. So if somebody wants to go on their next hunting adventure, they can contact us, and we'll hook them up with one of our 100 certified outfitters. And one of our outfitters came to us a couple years ago and said, you know, these people pay for these great hunts, and they're not ready to shoot at the target that we put them in front of. So we started the long-range school. So it's a ethical hunting long-range school. We're not teaching people to reach out past a 1,000 yards to shoot at game. We're teaching them how to know their distances and be able to ethically take animals at 300, 500 to 600 yards. You know, for some people, John, 350 yards is a long-range shot. So we started these schools, and then out of the success of those schools, we started to develop the wilderness survival and three-gun and tactical carbine as they all started to fill up.
That's awesome. I'll tell you what, for 50 yards is a long shot for me. 350 yards is a real long. I know some guys can sit there at 1,000 yards and, like, hit a bullseye all day. So I understand, Peter, how practical. This is a great idea.
Yeah, you know, the long-range schools really the long-range hunting schools really took off well because we spent a day measuring their skills against static targets, and then the second day we actually take them out on a course through the woods and make them practice those skills from leaning, bracing, using shooting sticks, shooting prone from targets anywhere from 50 yards out to 500 yards.
Wow, and think about it. What I really like about this, Peter, is that you know you do get out there on this hunting adventure, this outdoor or whatever this kind of expedition you're going on, and you're not going to have to take that time. You are going to be up to speed with what you need to do when you get out there. So it makes so much sense to me.
Yeah, and on the field day course of the long range school, we time them on their shot, just like it would be in a real world situation. So they know they've got to get their dope right on their scope. They got to get in the right position because they may only have 30 seconds to take that shot. So we actually use shot timers to make sure that they're aware of what's going to happen when they really get out there.
So that's Long Ranger's Wilderness Survival. Three-gun introduction, tactical carbine, and defensive handgun. A lot of stuff going on there.
There is, yes. And because the long range were so successful, we had the first one out in Wyoming. We've just developed a new school out in Texas, and then, of course, our Peacemaker location in West Virginia. They all were selling out. We're probably 8 months out, completely sold out on our long range schools. So we started to throw in some other options for people, and we've been very successful in filling those classes as well.
Wow. It's so great when the NRA provides this practical kind of service because it's what folks need because you want to get out there and you want to do it safely. You want to do it ethically, but you want to get out there and enjoy yourself too. So how can folks get more information about these programs?
You know, the best place to go is our website, which is NRAOutdoors.com.
So NRAOutdoors.com. Peter Churchborne, NRA Outdoors. Please check these programs out. So glad you guys are doing this. Another great service from the NRA. Thanks for what you're doing, sir, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart, talking about some of the big stories around the country. Also later in the hour, Rick Unger, co-host of Steel and Unger on Sirius XM, HOTUS 124, 6 to 9 p.m., talking about the campaigns hitting New York State. Right before we went to the end of the hour, talk about a story from usuncut.com, Hillary Clinton. Once again, going after Bernie Sanders, apparently her campaign team says this is a winning issue here. And so she tweeted what U.S. Uncut describes as a political attack at Sanders using the children killed in Sandy Hook as a political football. This is also, she said the exact same thing in an interview today, but this was her tweet, quote, Bernie Sanders prioritized gun manufacturers' rights over the parents of the children killed at Sandy Hook. So she tweeted it out. She said it in an interview. This was something that her campaign said, Hillary, you've got to do this. I don't know why they thought that she had to do that. But U.S. Uncut says immediately the comment thread for the tweet was full of angry Sanders supporters. But even Clinton supporters were disgusted, calling out the former Secretary of State for her insensitivity toward Sandy Hook victims. One Sanders supporter who had apparently been trying to convince her parents to switch their support from Clinton to Sanders said that the Sandy Hook tweet was what put them over the edge. Another Clinton supporter simply pleaded with her candidate to stand down. Amanda Girard at U.S. Uncut says a Facebook post from the relative of a Sandy Hook victim was perhaps the most heartbreaking of all. It featured a picture of six-year-old Allison Wyatt, one of the 20 children killed at Sandy Hook Elementary, with a plea for Hillary Clinton to stop bringing up the murders at Sandy Hook Elementary to smear Bernie Sanders. Other Twitter users agreed that the attack was one step too far. Other Twitter users, Amanda Girard says, pointed out the hypocrisy of Clinton's outspoken pro-gun control stance, as Clinton has a long record of selling hundreds of billions of dollars worth of American weapons to repressive Middle Eastern regimes. One Iraqi Twitter user brought up a quote from Clinton's private server emails in which the Secretary of State referred to war-torn Iraq as a, quote, business opportunity for corporate interests. Not going as well as the Hillary consultants thought that this attack would go. Good. All right, let's get to our hero of the day, our deal of the day, and our good guy of the day. We're going to be talking a little bit about Hillary Clinton and the deal of the day today, coming up here in just a couple of minutes. But right now, let's start with our hero of the day, sponsored by Adcor Defense. Jamie Hensley is a paramedic in the state of Tennessee, and he is petitioning for a change in law so that first responders can legally carry their concealed firearms if they are concealed carry holders. He told WCYB there in Tennessee that in his almost 30 years of working as a first responder, he has dealt with numerous calls that turned out to be dangerous. He said he's had knives pulled on him, guns pulled on him, was once held at gunpoint with fellow paramedics while responding to a call. He said it would be nice if we had some way to defend ourselves as a last-ditch effort. So he's got a petition up at change.org. Due to changing times, it is no longer safe for our first responders. We deserve the right to be able to protect ourselves and go home to our family. Brad Gerfen with the Washington County Johnson City, Tennessee EMS says he's not sure about this. Says that they've considered other safety measures such as bulletproof vests, but noted that such an endeavor would cost $200,000 to $300,000 more than what the budget would allow. Instead, he says good training is key and should include situational awareness and management of such calls, in addition to training first responders to know when to leave the call. But paramedics like Jamie Hensley say, you know, their ultimate goal is to go home at the end of the day. They would like to be able to carry to ensure that that they can. Apparently, in order to be delivered to lawmakers, the petition has to have 2,500 signatures. As of yesterday, they were about 600 short. But the petition has only been online there for a short period of time. So we'll keep our eyes on that story and on that issue there in Tennessee, and we'll let you know any updates as they become available. Our deal of the day. From Pennsylvania. As a matter of fact, not just from Pennsylvania, but from a column by Hillary Clinton at Penn Live. Join my fight to stop gun violence. This is her editorial. In this editorial, she says, many states have taken steps that make it harder for dangerous people to get guns illegally, and they have made a difference. But Pennsylvania has gone in the other direction. Even the most basic measures are now virtually impossible to pass thanks to Act 192. This so-called preemption law, she writes, was passed by Republicans in the General Assembly and signed into law by former Governor Tom Corbett before a court stepped in to rule against it. The law said that any town adopting gun reforms can be sued by the NRA. Read that sentence again, she writes. Her ghostwriter writes. It's as outrageous as it sounds. If this law is allowed to go into effect, the NRA will have standing in all those cases as if they were a Pennsylvania resident impacted by these laws. Or as if perhaps a member who is a resident of Pennsylvania is impacted by these laws. But again, to Hillary Clinton, apparently the NRA is like Wayne LaPierre and Chris Cox and then, who knows? Gun manufacturers, probably. No people. It's just a gun lobby. She says, cities have already faced serious consequences for laws that could prevent mass murders, like one that occurred recently outside of Pittsburgh in Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania. She says, just last year, Act 192 led Wilkinsburg to repeal its requirement to report stolen guns. City officials weighed the value of keeping this law against a costly lawsuit, and they decided that they couldn't afford to take the risk. Luckily, she says, a lower court has intervened, but Act 192 is now in the hands of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and it could become active once more. Hillary Clinton doesn't say how many times the town of Wilkinsburg actually charged somebody with not reporting a firearm lost or stolen. But I'm guessing the answer is zero. I'm guessing that's how many times. Pittsburgh had its own lost or stolen ordinance. How many times did they use it? Zero. Of the dozens of communities who took the advice of anti-gun activists there, primarily from the Brady campaign at the time, a fellow named Max Nashman, who was going around the community, you got to do this, you got to pass this, we got to send a message to the legislature. And by the way, the argument at the time was not, hey, these are going to be really effective laws here at the local level. The argument was, no, you got to send a message to the legislature that we want this done at the state level. And of the dozens of communities that passed that law that Hillary Clinton writes about, do you know how many of them actually used it? Again, I'm still waiting to find the case. I can't find any evidence that the law has ever been used. Hillary Clinton also doesn't tell you that when this bill was brought up in the legislature, and it was brought up in the legislature, this lost or stolen legislation, it was rejected by lawmakers. In large part because prosecutors, you know, the ones who would actually have to enforce this law, they said, we don't want this. We don't need this. This is not useful or helpful to us. What we would like to see are increased penalties for engaging in a straw purchase. And that's what lawmakers in Harrisburg actually passed. Not that Hillary Clinton mentions this at all. She says, we need to elect a president this November who will work with advocates and lawmakers across the country to change these laws and to keep leading the fight against gun violence. Here's what I do as president, she says. First, we need to repeal the sweeping liability protections that the gun industry enjoys. Gun dealers and manufacturers should be held liable if they break the law, just like every other industry in America. Well, that's a lie. Gun dealers and manufacturers are held liable if they break the law. The Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act prevents junk lawsuits from being filed against gun manufacturers and retailers seeking to hold them responsible for third-party actions of criminals. You have a design flaw? Well, you can still get sued. You have a safety defect? Oh, you can still get sued. Engage in a straw purchase? Oh, yeah, you can still face charges, not even civil suits. That's, I'm sorry, liar, liar, pantsuit on fire. Second, she says, we should build on President Barack Obama's recent executive orders and implement comprehensive criminal background checks that keep guns out of the hands of felons, abusers, and the severely mentally ill. Has she talked with any of these sheriffs? You know, the ones suing in Colorado, the ones opposed in Oregon, the ones opposed in Washington State to these universal background check bills. Has she talked with any of the law enforcement officers who have concerns about this? Because what they are saying is, you lawmakers can pass a law, because that's what you do. When a lawmaker says we have to do something, they mean we have to pass a law. And then it becomes our job to enforce the laws that you have enacted. And we don't know how the hell we're going to do this. We don't know how we're going to enforce these universal background checks. In fact, you got a lot of law enforcement who say, we can't. We don't have the manpower or the resources to devote to something like this. We don't have the manpower and the resources to devote investigations to burglaries. But sure, give us another law, give us another mandate. And again, you as a lawmaker, then your job is done because you've done something, right? You've passed a law. And when it doesn't work, you'll come right back and say, well, we need to do something else. We need to do more. We need to have more laws. And again, the individuals who are committing violent crimes in this country, they keep getting plea deals. They keep getting slaps on the wrist. They keep getting sentences like, I don't know, starts out second degree attempted murder, ends up with illegal possession of a firearm, 5 years behind bars, that turns into 25 months. You know, Hillary Clinton doesn't say anything about fixing that system. Nope. She hasn't mentioned the criminals at all. Again, gun industry. Got to do something with the gun industry. Executive orders, keeping guns out of the hands of felons, abusers, and the severely mentally ill. Well, that's not what universal background checks do. Third, she says, we need to close the so-called Charleston loophole. Right now, she says, a person with a violent felony conviction can get a gun if their background check isn't completed within 3 business days. She says, this is what is at stake in this election. So she doesn't say what she wants to do. If it will just leave it open until for however long it takes for a background check to come back. And if it doesn't, you know, I just sort of, eh. But she's got these focus-tested provisions that she wants to put in place. She says later in this piece, she says, in just the last 3 months, five Harrisburg men, Freddie J. Williams, John Thomas Carter III, Eric Byrd, Tyrell Curry, Andre Lamont Parker have been shot and killed. Andre was only 19 years old. She said, we need to stop these senseless deaths, and our kids, all our kids deserve the chance to grow up. They do. And again, Hillary Clinton's gun control proposals won't do a damn thing to make the streets of Harrisburg any safer. Or Chicago, or Washington, D.C., or Los Angeles, or Demarest, Georgia, for that matter. Because they're not aimed at the people who are committing the violent crimes. Now, a couple of those names that Hillary Clinton wrote about, Freddie J. Williams, John Thomas Carter III, Eric Byrd, Tyrell Curry, Andre Lamont Parker. This wasn't the first time that their names appeared in the paper there in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Freddie J. Williams, for instance, 2014, September 2014. 48-year-old Freddie J. Williams took the stand as a witness during a preliminary hearing for an individual charged with criminal homicide and other crimes in connection with the death of an 18-year-old. Relatives have said the two teenagers were cousins, but acknowledged that the suspect did not know that he was related to the victim at the time of the shooting. That decision came after a detailed testimony from Freddie J. Williams, who has a long criminal history dating back to at least 1988. Who testified in shackles in a prison jumpsuit because he said he was recently arrested on a parole violation. Freddie J. Williams conceded that he was drinking alcohol and hustling, meaning that he was selling drugs for someone else in exchange for crack cocaine in the hours leading up to the shooting. That was September of last year. Freddie J. Williams died in February of this year. When he died, Penn Live wrote another article. Neighbors react to shooting death in Allison Hill. They quoted Sam Mitchell, who said that he had known Freddie J. Williams since high school. He said, I've seen him more in jail than on the street sometimes. He was in and out of the system. Sam Mitchell said, I woke up. Said for his age, he should have been out of that vibe. He's a 49-year-old man. Described as, quote, someone who's gotten caught up in the drug culture. I've known him to be a chronic drug user. He suffered from a lot of the ills associated with substance abuse. He lived a life on the streets. He had difficulty with the law, committed low-level petty crimes, theft, drug possession, things of that nature. If you think another gun control law is going to help somebody like Freddie J. Williams, you are delusional. I got to be honest with you. I would love to see the Freddie J. Williams of the world get help and try to turn their life around. I don't want to think that age 49, just because you spend your entire life battling the demons of drug addiction and all that comes with it, that your life is lost. I don't want to believe that. But tell me how any of Hillary Clinton's gun control laws would have made an impact in the life or prevented the death of Freddie J. Williams. Because I'll be honest with you, I can't see it. John Thomas Carter III passed away a couple of weeks ago in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Investigators said that someone started a fight with the 36-year-old and shot him multiple times. He described by Penn Live as, quote, a man who struggled getting out from under the shadow of a criminal past that included drug arrests in 2003, 2006, and 2009. Sentenced to 2 to 4 years in prison in 2010. Penn Live says he was still, quote, trying to make that life turn. still trying to turn it around when he was shot there in Harrisburg. Again, I'd like to think that age 36, it's not too late to turn it around. But let's, again, acknowledge that in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, just like in Chicago, Illinois, just like in Los Angeles, California, just like in Washington, D.C., and every other city and community around this country, in even the worst neighborhoods, you've got more good people than bad. You have a small segment of the population that is responsible for committing these violent crimes. Within that subset of the population, again, in Chicago, estimated to be 6% of the population, could be less. You are also more likely to be the victim of a violent crime, in addition to being the perpetrator of a violent crime. Hillary Clinton doesn't want to, cannot, is unaware of the reality of crime in a lot of our communities. For whatever reason, she chooses to ignore the most effective way at restoring some safety and sanity to these streets. Instead, again, focusing her attention and her priorities and her rhetoric on the law-abiding legal gun owners in this country. Now, let's get to our good guy of the day. I know we're running a little long, so I'll just stick with one today. We'll talk about the story out of Pennsylvania tomorrow. CBS Los Angeles, with the story of a police officer, again, not kind of like yesterday, not in the right place at the right time, and willing and able to do the right thing, although I guess there's a little bit of that involved. This isn't just one moment here where an officer rises to the occasion. Officer Ramon Lamelli says he never knows what his day is going to bring as a police officer. I imagine that is absolutely the case. But he says one day in particular in his 8 years with the force there in L.A. stands out. It was around Christmas, and Ramon Lamelli met this little girl named Brianna, who is 9. She was selling candy, and she was trying to raise funds for a wig because Brianna, who is 9, has alopecia universalis, which means that her body doesn't grow hair. If you have been around kids these days, you know that, nothing much has changed. Kids can be pretty cruel. Ramon Lamelli said, as a parent, it breaks your heart. So Lamelli bought her holiday gifts, and he gave her $100, which she spent on a dress for her birthday. He said, you should have seen her eyes. They just glowed. CBS in Los Angeles says that would have been enough to warrant a story talking about Officer Lamelli's generosity. But Ramon Lamelli thought that he could do more. He said, I went home and it was Brianna, Brianna, Brianna in the back of my head. You have to do something about it, right? So Officer Lamelli went to his supervisors, who told a friend who decided to donate a wig. Justine Makoff says, I wanted to help because I think it's really important for people to know that there is a human on the other side of the badge. And so this past Sunday, Brianna and Officer Lamelli and Brianna's mom were there taking measurements because Brianna is going to get the wig that she has been wishing for a while. Yanath Benevente, who is Brianna's mom, says that she told Officer Lamelli, quote, I'm very grateful to him for caring. So, again, a story that wouldn't necessarily get on the nightly news. A tip of the cap to CBS in Los Angeles for covering the story, but a much bigger tip of the cap to Officer Ramon Lamelli of the LAPD for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, stick around. When we come back after a quick time out here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, Dr. AWR Hawkins joins us from Breitbart later in the hour. Rick Unger of Steel and Unger. We'll be right back with much more NRA News, Cam and Company right after this.
Speaking with Bobby Wiggins with Warrior Outdoors, welcome to NRA News. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
Well, right here on your card, sir, it says Healing for Heroes. That's Tell great. Us, what are you all about? What do you do?
Warrior Outdoors is a nonprofit organization. We are geared towards helping veterans, particularly with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries. We take vets and first responders to on outdoor activities, hunting, fishing, monster truck shows, to paintball, I mean, just anything outdoors to help prevent withdrawal.
How'd you get this started?
I'm actually a service-connected disabled vet myself. I'll go ahead and tell you, my rating with the VA is 70%. When I was medically discharged from the Marine Corps, I did a lot of my own therapy. I signed an inch-thick book of papers saying I couldn't talk about this, couldn't see, do anything.
Right.
So I went out to a tree stand with a hunting rifle, and that's where I spent the majority of my time doing my own rehab. So it was like a light switch that clicked and said, I cannot be the only person like this. So I started this organization and built a great team to help me out, and that's now I'm sitting here with you.
That's so awesome. It's great, Bobby, to see you when people do this. And out of necessity, what's born this kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. out of necessity was born Warrior Outdoors, because this is what you had to do for yourself, and now you're doing it for others.
That's correct. Not saying that any other organization out there is bad, because they're all good. It's just we can't have enough organizations like this helping veterans.
Absolutely.
We have 22 veterans a day. Right now, the numbers from the DOD, it's 22 veterans a day committing suicide.
Oh.
One is too many.
How do we get more information about Warrior Outdoors?
You can visit the website, warrioroutdoors.org.
Bobby, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you.
I'm a mom, and just like millions of other women, that's why I own guns. We're responsible, we're law-abiding, and we're everything that makes America strong. Every day, we're willing to use a firearm to defend our families. But the media will never tell those stories. If a mom puts a gun to the face of a home-invading thug and makes him run for his life, the story gets buried. But if she's unarmed and murdered, the cameras will be at the scene before the police. It's time for moms like me to speak out. We are the majority. We demand the freedom to defend our families. And we challenge the media to tell the truth about our rights. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
The Ayatollahs of Iran and every terrorist you enable. Listen up. You might have met our fresh-faced flower child president and his weak-kneed Ivy League friends. But you haven't met America. You haven't met the heartland where the people will defend this nation with their bloody, calloused, bare hands. That's what it takes. You haven't met the steel workers and the hard rock miners or the swamp folks in Cajun country who can wrestle a full-grown gator out of the water. You haven't met the farmers, the cowboys, the loggers, and the truck drivers. You don't know the mountain men who live off the land or the brave cops who fight the good fight in the urban war zones. No, you've never met America. And you ought to pray you never do. I'm the National Rifle Association of America. And I'm freedom's safest place.
Rick Unger of Steel and Unger coming up on the program.
We don't take no
and a tribute to Merle Haggard there. Dr. AWR Hawkins of Breitbart News joins us on the program. How you doing, Dr. Hawkins?
Doing great, Cam. Great to be with you.
It is good to be with you as well. I appreciate you coming on the program. Did you happen to catch The View today?
Yeah, I have a few articles that will start posting throughout the afternoon on The View.
Oh, yes, excellent. Excellent. All right, we've got a clip here. We're not going to be able to share the entire thing, but I want to share just a little bit of this clip, Dr. Hawkins, kind of set things up, because if you're writing about it and we're talking about it, there's a reason why. So take a look and a listen at a little bit of today's episode of The View.
You know, Bernie Sanders is going to be here tomorrow. Bernie's going to be here tomorrow. And he's getting a little bit of angry backlash for saying that families who lost loved ones in the Sandy Hook school massacre should not be able to sue the gun manufacturer. Now, he has very specific points. What do you guys think?
Well, I don't understand it personally. One, let me say this. I've never had a mass shooting happen to someone in my family. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that feels like, mm-hmm. first and foremost. However, speaking from the outside, I don't think it's fair for those families to sue the gun manufacturers. I think they should talk to the government, because they're the ones who put it in law that these kind of guns can be sold.
That's right.
And I think that it's unfair to go to these people who are trying to make their money, no matter, you know, people make all kinds mm-hmm. of products that can kill someone, mm-hmm. let's just be honest, yeah. cars and everything else, but you don't sue them for it. Mm-hmm. You need to go to the government and say the Second Amendment was made at a time when we needed to protect ourselves from whoever's going to show up at our door for war. Now we have all kinds of stuff that we don't need. We don't need these guns everywhere. And I have a gun. Mm-hmm. I don't need it. I got it. But I mean, I don't use
why
it.
Do you have it.
Why do I have? Because I'm from the South, and I learned how to shoot guns when I was younger, and it's just a part of my life. Now, if I wasn't taught that at a young age, I would go to the gun range to know. But I don't really need it. Mm-hmm. I don't use it. I'm never going to shoot nobody.
Let's stop there. There's a little flavor of the view. And honestly, Dr. Hawkins, you know, it's interesting. I'm looking at a story here from U.S. Uncut talking about the flag that Hillary Clinton has gotten online today for her tweet, in which she talks about Bernie Sanders signing with gun manufacturers over the parents of murdered children. She's getting a lot of pushback, including from people who've actually lost their children there at Sandy Hook Elementary, saying, stop, this is not appropriate, and you know, stop using this as a line of attack. As far as the actual legal argument goes, you see the trouble that Hillary Clinton is running into here, because, you know, even the women of The View were not convinced that, you know, they're all in favor of gun control, Dr. Hawkins, right? But the idea of suing a manufacturer of a product when somebody criminally misuses that product, even for The View, that seemed to be a step too far.
Right. You're exactly right. You know, I believe that was Raven who was speaking. And, you know, she said that she, you know, if you listen to her argument, by the time she kind of starts in defense of gun manufacturers, she tries to find some place that she could agree with Whoopi, but ends up coming back to her roots and defending gun rights versus the lawsuit. And so it's exactly to your point. And on top of that, you have, if you look at some of the other hosts, some that I wrote on, there's an outright defense of AR-15s in specific on The View. Mm-hmm. And so you're exactly right. You know, the arguments to sue a manufacturer who legally manufactures a product and then the sellers who legally sell that product, the idea that those people can be sued for someone legally buying a product and that product later being misused, It really has no support, not broad based support, and as you're exactly right, The View proves that.
You know, it was interesting. At one point, they start talking about they can't really get behind the legal theory, but they can certainly get behind gun control. And so,
right.
I think at one point it was Whoopi Goldberg who talked about, well, you know, one of the arguments here is that there's no reason why people should own these guns, right? This is what the lawyers are arguing. In this case, that the manufacturer was somehow wrong or negligent in selling this firearm because this is a gun that belongs on the modern battlefield weapons of war. And you're right, Jedediah Beale actually pushed back against that argument. But right. then I think it was Whoopi Goldberg who said, "Well, what can you do with these guns? You can't hunt with these guns. You'll turn a deer to dust."
Yeah, it was so embarrassing. I heard that she said, "You will turn them to deer dust."
Yeah.
She know how little a .223 round is?
No.
It's a .22 caliber bullet that has a lot. It just has more powder behind it. Yes, it's a little longer than your typical long rifle bullet, but it's the same width. And I mean, it's sad. You know, in Texas, I hate to tell you, I don't hate to tell you, I'm not ashamed of it. It's illegal. But in Texas, we've shot deer with a 223. We've shot pigs with a 223. We've killed a ton of coyotes with a 223.
Mm-hmm.
And in no instance did I walk up and find coyote, deer, or pig dust. In every instance, I walked up on an animal who was killed with a very short round in a gun that's light and comfortable to carry. So you have it, and you can have it on spot immediately if you see your game moving in front of you. It's a great gun to hunt with. It really is.
You know,
for that type of hunting.
Well, it is. You know, we've talked about our Hero of the Day segment every day is sponsored by AdCor Defense. We've talked with Clinton Romache about his AdCor rifle that he's been using up there in North Dakota as a varmint gun ever since he got it a couple of years ago. And he says, I don't know how many thousands of rounds I've put through it by now. You go back to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals decision, which came out, about a month or so ago. And in that case, the three-judge panel said specifically, look, these guns are constitutionally protected. They are owned by millions of Americans. They are in common use for lawful purposes by millions of Americans. They are not dangerous and unusual. They are, covered under the Second Amendment, and told the trial court there in Maryland, you need to go back and reconsider this lawsuit under the facts of this case. Now, again, that decision is being sent up to an en banc review in the Fourth Circuit. But again, it shows the challenge and really the falseness of this argument that we're still trying to, or I shouldn't say we. They are still trying to make this argument at this point in time, Dr. Hawkins, that the most popular rifle in America today, which millions of Americans own, again, for self-defense, for hunting, for competitive shooting, for recreation, that somehow this firearm, which has been around since the 1960s, is somehow so newfangled and modern that it belongs on a battlefield and only a battlefield, and no way can this fall under the purview of the Second Amendment.
Right. No, you're exactly right. They're digging in. In my opinion, they're digging in on the AR-15 because they've lost all ground for every other argument in every other sphere of gun control. That's my opinion. But gun control at the federal level, you and I know, it's DOA, apart from some executive actions that the president may think of to take. And I think the AR-15 is something they view as the last ground of ignorance. And they want to keep preying on the ignorance of Americans who don't know better. The good news is, because of your show, because of the NRA, because of Breitbart News, a lot of Americans are realizing, hold up, this gun only shoots one round every time you pull the trigger. It can't shoot more than one round every time you pull the trigger. And because so many people are buying the gun, they're realizing, hold on, this is not only not a military weapon, this is a remarkable weapon that even a novice can quickly be taught how to use for self-defense and hunting. The more we get that message out and the more people experience that firsthand, we will soon see we'll be able to even take this argument away from the left, and they're going to have to find something entirely new to begin pushing because everything else is caving in on them. That's my opinion, but that's what I see as I write on this every day, as I listen to you, and as I read myself.
Well, and you know that they'll find something, Dr. Hawkins. We know that. Listen, we got to run, unfortunately, but I appreciate you coming on the program. It is always a pleasure talking with you, and I look forward to reading your reports here on The View later today.
All right. Thank you. Great to be with you, my friend. God bless.
You bet. We'll see you soon. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins at Breitbart with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Yeah, when you've lost Raven Simone, right. All right. When we return here on NRA News, Cam and Company, Rick Unger, the co-host of Steel and Unger on SiriusXM POTUS. You can check him out, of course, weeknights, 6 to 9 p.m. on the POTUS channel. We'll talk about the campaigns hitting the Empire State. It is going to be a crazy couple of weeks there in the media capital of the known universe. Stick around. We'll be back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
For your service and all that you've done. So tell me, how did you get involved with the Warrior Angels Foundation?
Well, Andrew and I have actually known each other for at least 15 years. We went to high school together, so we grew up together in a lot of ways. But I served in a 3rd Ranger Battalion in the Army, and after my deployment to northern Iraq, came back, and during the training operation, I suffered a traumatic brain injury. My parachute didn't open fully. So, therefore, I was then medically discharged from the Army. And shortly after being discharged, I was drugged up incredibly. And within about 18 months, my entire life just started to spiral downward.
I'd like to ask you guys, I mean, there's certainly been a lot of controversy over the Veterans Administration, the VA hospital system. I want to focus, though, really how that applies to this particular issue.
Right.
You know, the VA, for all of its other problems, generally is regarded pretty as a pretty high-quality provider for very specific battle-type, service-related injuries, service-related illnesses. Why do you think they haven't quite got a grasp on PTSD? Because this has been something that has obviously been an issue, really, going back to the Vietnam War, which is when we started really seeing a lot of these cases come back.
You have to really look at what is post-traumatic stress, and you have to look at traumatic brain injury. What we're now finding out is the majority of people are massively misdiagnosed with post-traumatic stress. By definition, post-traumatic stress is purely a behavioral and psychological issue. So if there is any physical trauma in that person's timeline, by definition, it can't be post-traumatic stress. So the first thing we need to look at is traumatic brain injury. And that's when we go and we say, okay, well, let's do an independent objective analysis of his blood to see where he's at. And we can then see, okay, this person is deficient in these very important neurosteroids that are responsible for making us who we are, cognition, behavior, our physiology, our psychology. Everything is wrapped up in it. And so if that is messed up and it's deficient and it's not working correctly, now we're going to have all these declines that we see in somebody's behavior. And it happens. It can happen slowly. It can happen during a day, a week, a month, a year after the injury. And so when that happens and a person starts having issues, they can't tie it to any one event. And they're going to the doctor and they're saying, I don't know what's happening, but I think I'm going crazy. And I don't have any reason to. And instead of doing their due diligence, the medical system, they say, okay, great, you're going on packet number A of drugs. And when that doesn't work 3 months later, we'll up it and put you on packet B. So if you say you're depressed and you're put on antidepressants and you're still depressed, then that's probably not what's wrong.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's where we are in the system. So the good news is, We weren't going to wait around for the government to solve it. My family didn't have the time. We have people in need. So we went out and found an alternative means, and we're disrupting the entire system.
That's great. I mean, is the VA listening now?
We've been in conversations with the highest echelons of the VA, and they're not going to have a choice. It's going to be one of two things. It's either going to go, they're going to have to accept it, or the current technology is going to advance so much that it'll democratize and dematerialize the current healthcare system. Where, right. You know, it's like, hey, do whatever you want. We can get this groundbreaking therapy, whether you want to pay for it or not.
Talking again with Andrew Marr, the CEO and founder of the Warrior Angels Foundation, and Chase Rowan as well with community relations for the foundation. So how do you folks raise funds, Andrew? What do you do to...
We're a 501c3, so we're a nonprofit organization. So we function off people's generosity. And the way I look at it is an investment. You're investing in somebody's life. We've now been able to treat over 100 veterans. Many were on a multitude of medications and had more than one attempt at suicide. And the majority of our guys are completely off all medications and back and living life again.
That's amazing.
Wow. That is amazing.
That's great. So we're just bringing the results and letting people understand what's out there and saying, hey, if this is a value to you, and it is to us, then this is a great way for you to be able to give back.
Well, listen, again, we cannot thank you enough for everything that you've done for this country, and thank you again for everything you continue to do.
It's on our website, Chase, www.waftbi.org. We have a plethora of information on there, put out a ton of stuff on brain health, all the social media. We're the cool kids with social media these days, so we're on all the hot links, and we're putting out, dropping knowledge bombs left and right.
Andrew, listen, thank you so much for coming by. It's a real pleasure.
Pleasure's ours.
Chase, thank you as well, sir.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much for tuning in to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. I am absolutely thrilled to have with us on the program right now, co-host of Steel and Unger on Sirius XM POTUS, Mr. Rick Unger. Rick, how you doing, sir?
I'm good, Cam. How's it going?
It is going very well. I appreciate you starting your work day a little bit earlier.
No worries.
and I've got to tell you, I am still devoted to Patriot. You know, on my way home, I will listen to the great one, Mark Levin, but I will also tune over and listen to POTUS 124. And I have to say, I really, really enjoy Steele and Unger. It is a fantastic program.
Pleased and flattered.
Yeah, well, listen, that is not mere flattery. I would tell you if it sucked, actually. I'd say, Rick.
Straighten out your show, man.
I'm telling you, buddy, you got some issues here. But, no, it's actually fantastic. And I know that, you know, with the campaigns moving into New York now, we're probably going to be hearing, perhaps, some candidates on POTUS and on the Steele and Unger show.
Yeah, I think you probably will.
So are you ready, Rick, for campaign season to make it swing into the Empire State?
Yeah, you know, for us, to tell you the truth, Kev, it doesn't change our lives dramatically. We are going to be broadcasting live next Thursday from the State Republican Gala, and that's going to give us an opportunity. I think we're going to have John Kasich on the show, and hopefully Mr. Trump and Senator Cruz also. They'll all be there doing their thing, so we hope to have them all there. It should be fun.
What, you know, coming out of Wisconsin, Bernie Sanders, a big win, for Ted Cruz. The polling indicates that in New York, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton hold substantial leads right now. Is the storyline for the New York primary, is it already written, Rick, or do you think that it's still up in the air?
I think it's probably already written on the Republican side. Well, you know, you could see maybe Trump slipping a few points, and that becomes a story because there are benefits here to getting over 50%. So if he were to slide below that, it could cost him a few delegates, but it's very hard to see anybody overcoming him. In fact, in New York right now, Senator Cruz is running in third place. Kasich is closer than he is to mm-hmm. Trump, and I kind of don't think that that's going to change all that much. On the Democratic side, you don't know. I mean, Bernie gets such incredible audience response. He came in here last week. He had a rally up in the Bronx. I think he had 15,000 people, and that's kind of unheard of. So you don't know. Hillary has slipped some in the polls, but she is still leading. My personal projection is that Hillary will probably hold on to win, but that could change. That could change. But you do have to keep this in mind. Even if she were to lose New York, it would be very embarrassing for her since it is her home state. It is the state she represented in the Senate. But he would not likely win by a wide enough margin that it's going to have a dramatic impact on the delegate count. I think it's going to be very hard for him to overcome that unless he gets some massive wins in a bunch of important states.
No, I think that you're right. And so that, you know, it's interesting because that brings up a possibility of a Democratic election in which there is considerable support for Sanders among the the proletariat in the party there, but then the super delegates, the advanced guard, the vanguard there, the revolutionary vanguard, Rick, they're all lining up behind Hillary Clinton. And it seems to me like that is going to provide an environment in which there's there could be a lot of acrimony and animosity between those two camps if there is
There certainly could. I mean, listen, superdelegates have been a part of Democratic conventions for as long as I can recall.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, there's no question that if he were to get – well, the worst thing that could happen would be if he somehow pulled ahead of her in the popular vote, in the elected delegate count. That would really cause a lot of trouble. Presuming that doesn't happen, look, you know, there are going to be superdelegates out there who are going to look at the fact that Bernie has won, what, 7 out of the 8 last primaries. If he were to pull off a win in New York, they're going to be scratching their heads. But at the end of the day, they're going to stick with Hillary for a very simple reason. They know what I know, which is Bernie is not going to beat a Republican in the November election, whereas Hillary, if we were to get the two front-running candidates of the Republican Party today, and we might not, she would probably have not too difficult of a time beating them. So I think that would be the result. But you're absolutely right. If it's close, or if Bernie were to pull ahead in elected delegates, and the superdelegates gave it to Hillary, it would be an ugly situation.
Talking again with Rick Unger, co-host of Steele and Unger. So, Rick, one of the things that Hillary Clinton is doing in New York right now, she is hitting Bernie Sanders hard on guns again.
Yeah.
And in a couple of different ways. Apparently, she met in Albany, a private meeting with lawmakers there. You've got a couple of lawmakers who say that Hillary Clinton told them that Vermont guns are responsible for New York crime, which has led to Clinton superdelegate Peter Shumlin, the governor of Vermont, coming out and saying, no, that's not the case. And as a matter of fact, saying, you know, look, it's campaign season. Candidates are going to say things. I mean, you know, when your own superdelegate is basically correcting you and saying, and by the way, according to ATF figures, there were 55 firearms recovered that were originally sold in Vermont, recovered in New York in 2014. So Hillary Clinton is wrong on this.
Yeah.
She's also beating up Bernie Sanders, saying that Bernie Sanders cares more about gun manufacturers than the families of the children murdered at Sandy Hook. Because he doesn't think that gun manufacturers should be sued, seeking to hold them responsible for the actions of criminals.
Well, on the first point you raised, yeah, I mean, I think that's pure politics. Listen, I mean, New York does have pretty stringent gun laws, and a lot of guns come in from surrounding states. I don't think that, I don't know, and I completely believe you when you say only 55. That makes sense to me. I wouldn't have thought that Vermont would be one of those leading suppliers, if you will. So I'm disinclined to buy that, as you are. The second one's a little more complicated, because what she's referring to, and she's purposely not being specific about it, but you know the history of the law that Bernie supported, what was it, in 2005?
Yeah.
And it was really not about defective guns. It was not about, you know, let's blame the gun manufacturer when somebody uses it in a way that it wasn't intended. It was really about lines of distribution. And what that was about, New York City had sued the gun manufacturers, pointing out that, according to federally supplied research, that they were able to track 36,000 guns used in 36,000 criminal offenses to just 136 stores. So the argument was, look, if we have this data and you know that this tiny little number of stores, I mean, there are a lot of gun shops out there. If this tiny little number of stores is responsible for this much criminal use of guns, then they're obviously putting guns out on the black market. They're obviously not playing the way the gun manufacturers would want them to play. So why can't you simply stop selling to those 136 stores? Go and sell to anybody else you want. That's your right. And what happened was the NRA didn't like that. And so they very effectively lobbied Congress to get a law passed, which basically blocked off that lawsuit. Bernie supported that because Bernie felt that he wanted to not have pressure put on gun dealers up in Vermont. You know, there's a lot of hunting in Vermont and a lot of gun dealers who sell guns to people who hunt. So he was basically just looking out for people in his state. So, yeah, I can understand that. Now, though, what she's not saying is that he has gotten behind, in fact, co-sponsored a bill that picks that issue up again. And, you know, my take on this is I don't think guns rights activists would be offended by the idea that if you've got 136 stores out of all the thousands and thousands of gun stores in America who may not be following the right procedures and who may be pumping guns into the black market, well, these people don't buy their guns in the black market. They buy them legitimately. So I'm not sure that they would care that much about those stores.
Rick, it's our first disagreement. Are you excited?
Ah, there we go. Finally.
Because here's where I'm going to disagree with you a little bit. I think that you go back to the mid-90s when Hillary Clinton was first lady and her husband was president of the United States, and there really was a strategy, not just to go after gun stores, and the theory was that they were supplying criminals intentionally. This strategy to bankrupt gun manufacturers to get that big tobacco-style payout against the gun industry. And by the time 2005 rolled around and the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act was brought up and passed in Congress, you had well over two dozen states around the country that had already implemented their own laws because they were looking at these types of junk lawsuits proceeding. And so Congress actually was sort of late to act. There were a lot of states that had acted first. Congress was the sort of the last measure here. And as you well know, the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, it doesn't prevent lawsuits against design flaws or safety
issues, things of that nature. It's not a full immunity statute.
No. Right. And in this case, this lawsuit in Connecticut, the argument is that the manufacturer should not have been selling this firearm to civilians, should not have been marketing this firearm, because they say this firearm it belongs on a battlefield of war. And even the Washington Post today said this is a an argument that is not likely to make it.
That's actually a separate issue from what fed into the law in 2005. You're right. That is going on. See, and I agree with the first part of what you said, Kim. You're absolutely right that a strategy of the Clinton administration was to try and bankrupt the gun manufacturers. No argument at all. I do think, however, that what precipitated all the history that I've read about it, what precipitated the law in 2005 was the New York City court case. I kind of wish that court case would have gone forward because, you know, there's a lot of industries that really do. They understand that there is a negligence aspect. It's a tort law thing. It's not a Second Amendment rights thing where we just saw it, in fact. The fast food company, I'm forgetting the name, that they had all those people get sick when they came in. All of those stores are franchise owned. So it's not even the company itself, but yet the company has a responsibility when it comes to overseeing their channel of distribution, to make sure that their franchises are behaving properly. So what's going to happen here now, because they are not protected the way the gun companies are in that situation, when people who got sick sue, they're not just going to be suing the franchisee. They're going to be suing the main company for what happened to them. Now, the main company will probably turn around and sue the franchisee or has indemnities or whatever. But it's just an example of where the gun manufacturers do get a protection that very few other companies would have. You can kind of compare it most fairly to the car companies. Automobile manufacturers have similar means of protection as gun companies. So my whole thing on it is I don't think gun companies should be responsible if somebody takes their gun and hurts somebody. They didn't make the gun. They made the gun for a purpose. Nobody put a gun to your head and said you have to buy it. So if it's not defective, then they shouldn't be on the hook. I do, however, think it's worth exploring if they are negligent in looking into their lines of distribution when you can identify that there's this tiny handful of stores out there.
All right, with that, Rick, unfortunately, the music means we've got to run.
I know.
Well, let's have you back because I've got a rebuttal.
Well, yeah, let's continue. I'm sure you do.
All right, buddy. Have a good show tonight. We'll see you
All
soon.
Right, you too, man.
Rick Unger, I'll give you my rebuttal on tomorrow's Cam and Company as well. Have a great afternoon, everyone. We'll see you soon.